to get us going here. This is Roger Eardley Pryor conducting an oral history with Katrina Baxter. We are at the United Way building in Philadelphia on Benjamin Franklin Parkway. It is July 27th, 2017. Katrina, could you spell your name for us?
Yes, it's K-I-R-T-R-I-N-A, Baxter, B-A-X-T-E-R.
Great. And when were you born?
1969.
1969, that's a good year.
Good year, right.
Where were you born?
I was born in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't think my family lived there long, so we were there for about maybe a year and a half. No, longer than that, because my sister underneath me is about, she and I are about 14 months apart, and she was born there too, and then we moved after her, so maybe when I was three, we moved to Willingboro, New Jersey.
Okay.
And I don't remember New Brunswick at all.
What do you remember about Willingboro?
Well, I was in Willingboro all my childhood, so I lived and grew up there. And so I remember a lot about Willingboro.
tell me a little bit about your family. You mentioned you have a sister. What's her name?
Yeah, I have three sisters. Yes, and there are Tracy, Trisha, and Tremaine. Mm-hmm. We're all TRs, by extension, some of us. And we grew up, it was three of us growing up, though. My little younger sister wasn't born until we were in high school, so she didn't really grow up with us. Per se. So we had three girls growing up in Willingboro, New Jersey, which at the time in the 70s was majority white. It was right after redlining, you know, had sort of been squashed. So we were able to move into, you know, this suburb area, into this, you know, like, you know, in a nice neighborhood, so, supposedly. So it was, you know, it was a really, actually, I call it a charmed experience growing up, because my block was very unique in that, you know, the neighbors across the street were Seventh Day Adventists, and they were people of color. Our neighbors next door were Jewish. Our neighbors on the other side were Catholic. You know, we had Italian family on a block, a family from Haiti, and some Puerto Ricans, right? A male nurse. Like, we had a lot of diversity, just like on our block.
Yeah.
And as you know, as a child, everything is about your block, right? So, like, my whole life was the block. And the black church. So my dad's a pastor. My parents now co-pastor. At the time, he was just a pastor. And so, you know, we had always had a black community of support all my life because of the black church. So when I think back on, you know, my childhood, you know, I've always had this support of black folks around me, right? Even though we lived in this majority white community. And on my block, you know, it was very diverse. So I even thought about or experienced a whole lot of what an experience, a whole lot of racism growing up that I, you know, that I took and understood as racism. I don't think I had my first experience. I knew about it because we talked about it. You know, it was very much a part of what our conversations were at home. You know what I mean? The experience of black folks in this society. My dad was a black radical preacher, very much so akin to the conversation or the sermons that you would hear that they talked about a lot with Obama's first preacher, and they were like, that he had to distance himself from because of, like, all the stuff that he would talk about in his pulpit, which for me was a very regular thing in the black pulpit, right? You know, the conversations that he was having that people took offense to, or conversations that we constantly have in our community because it's important.
They need to
and
be
it
told.
Needs to be, yeah. And they need to be told, right? And had. So that, you know, so my childhood was, you know, sort of one that included resistance, that included an understanding and a political understanding of our place in society, and also being girls, all of us girls, you know, my dad and my parents were very much about, you can do whatever you want, you know what I'm saying? So, like, we didn't have a huge patriarchal, you know, sort of like, you know, this is what girls do type thing. You know, my sisters were ball players, you know, I mean, my dad was a coach, you know, and he didn't have any boys, so he didn't have no choice but to inspire us to, you know, to do whatever we wanted to do. And, you know, I don't know, in the church you do, you know, the patriarchy in the church is real, right? And a lot of religious institutions. And I think that when I think back, though, on my parents' relationship, and also see it now, and it's and what it is, that although, you know, the onus of having, you know, the male be the, you know, the leader or the head of the household, my parents were always in a shared space of decision making, and my mother's voice and word was always heard and always valued, right?
Can you tell me a little bit more about your parents? They sound, they sound wonderful.
They're pretty awesome.
What are their names?
So Lily and Kirk, Baxter. They're still married, 50-something years now, so they're pretty, and, like, best friends, which is really an amazing feat.
Yes. And so my parents are as well. Uh-huh. And it's in some ways it's intimidating.
Yeah.
Right? You're like, they did it. They found it. Like, they made it work.
True. I think it's a generational thing, though. I totally look at it like, you know what? Everyone's not going to have that. A lot of folks from their generation have that, and we're able to hold on to that. Mm. You know, and I'm thankful for that they were like this example of, you know, what could be. You know, my mom used to say to me, why do you have such a bad view of marriage? It's like, because it doesn't come from us. It's like, you're right. It comes from everyone else around us,
right,
you know?
Yeah,
we are in this like isolated island of, you know, protecting families, you know, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And loving and encouraging families. So my dad very much was the disciplinary, I don't even say that, because my mom is a very strong woman.
How did they meet?
They met, I don't know, the church.
Oh yeah,
they met in church. So my dad is a second generation, maybe third generation pastor. So he's been preaching in their family forever. Mm-hmm. My mother grew up in Philadelphia, so she's from here. All her family's from here, and for most of the part, you know, they came up, migrated from Virginia, and they have a very strong. She's 12 siblings, and so
that's
a big family. My father only has 4, but they have 12 in their family, and all the women in my mom's family are really strong women and presences in my life, like, throughout. And so they met in high school when she, like, in the 12th grade, I think, when at a conference here in Philadelphia, at the church conference or something. And he lived in Coatesville, which is like a little country place outside of town, and, you know, and to him, to her, he was like totally country, because she's from the, you know, this big girl from the city, from this huge family that's, you know, my uncles were badasses. So he said he used to, when he'd come to visit her, he would, like, you know, tell people, I'm going to see Jazz's sister, and they would leave him alone. my uncles were in gangs, you know. So they're pretty interesting, and that they came from two different walks of life. My grandmother was a single parent. Her husband passed away.
Which grandmother?
My mother's mother. Yeah, her husband passed away when my mother was young, so she raised the children on her own.
Wow.
Right. Well, and not completely, because of course, you know, she has an extended family who had helped at times. Some of my uncles were raised up down south.
Mm-hmm.
She raised most of the girls. And of most of the guys, actually just 2 of them grew up down south. So, but, you know, they had help. So, you know, everything within our families for a long time was very integrated. So, you know, the raising of children is something that everyone participated in.
Takes a village, right?
Yeah, definitely. So my grandmother lived to be 94. So she was pretty present in my life for a long time. My dad's mother is still living, and she's 103. And she's still in Coatesville, Pennsylvania.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you're growing up in Williamsburg?
Willingboro.
Mm-hmm. And you're coming to visit Philadelphia and seeing all this family.
Yeah.
What were your memories of those experiences being in Philly as a little girl?
Yeah, oh man, we had lots of fun. It was like, you know, this is where you come to do all the things you couldn't really do in the suburbs. Like, but we played the same games, really, you know. It was just a lot more dangerous, right? More cars going by. You know, jumping rope crossing the street was a big deal, of being able to stay out because you're visiting your cousins. So that doesn't really matter where we were. You know, when you get all the cousins together, you know, you just get into things that you wouldn't normally get into. So we had, you know, summers were spent, and, you know, with our cousins here in the city. I think about that now, about how, you know, people used to, like, when my mom was growing up, they would spend summers in the South, right? And then after years, you know, progressing, we had been so removed from the South. Folks spent their city, you know, folks who moved out to the suburbs spent the summers in the cities, which is a very interesting contrast that I've been sort of pondering lately.
What do you think about it?
Yeah, I'm thinking about wanting to know other people's experience about that, and to see, like, you know, what we lost, right, from not going down to the country, but going to the city. The difference between, like, going, you know, they were sent down to the country before, when, you know, people were like, or if a child wasn't, you know, manageable, or if they were, you know, with the punishment was, you know, you send you down south. But when you go down south, you had this really visceral experience with the environment, right, and nature, and maybe fishing, depending on where your family lives, and definitely farming, you know, where your family lives. And so, you know, it's like picking food, and, you know, having those experiences grounded a lot of people in the generations before, in the generation before me. And then those of us who didn't have that experience by going to the South, we were going to the city, the very different grounding, right? A very different experience of kinship. But one not really attached to the land. And because, you know, my work is around land and the environment, I think always about when were the times that we were able to, you know, reach out and touch the land in certain ways. Like when we were kids in Philadelphia, we would, my cousins and I would catch bees. Everything was catching lumber, like those carpenter bees, like the big fat ones, which is like, it's so mean. I don't know why we did that. Put them in jars, you know, kept them on our cabinet, along with lightning bugs. Of course, everyone caught lightning bugs. Mm-hmm. But every now and then I talk about how we used to take off the bug, the little glowy part, and put them on as like ring of fingers. And people would be like, ew, I can't believe you did that. And I was just like, I thought everyone did that.
Yeah,
everyone
did that.
But people are like, that was so mean. I was like, you're right, it was mean. We were cruel kids. Mm-hmm. So we did things like that in the city, you know. We didn't go to public pools much. Like that was something that we had a lot of pools in the suburbs. So one of the, you know, also spent all summer long at the pool. And so in the city, it was like one of those things you couldn't do. So we didn't like to come for long periods of time because that meant that we couldn't swim, you know, because you don't go to public schools and public pools in Philly, apparently. Mm. Now they do. I don't know what it was for back in the day, but my parents, my family were like, yeah, no going to the public pool. So most of my cousins in the city couldn't swim. So they didn't know how to swim.
Yeah.
So we'd do different things. But we go to the beach every summer with my family. We go to the south, Virginia. Mm-hmm. We have family reunions every year, and when we were children growing up. And you know, it's interesting how we lose, you know, we don't do that anymore. They still have them apparently, but we don't do them anymore.
Where in Virginia do you remember being?
We're in Goochland, so my family's from Goochland, Virginia, which is about 45 minutes outside of Richmond.
Okay.
East of Richmond. And and then we would always stop through Virginia Beach on the way home, right? So then we'd go to the beach for a day or two on the way home, me and my cousins and my aunts and uncles, and it was fun. So that was our summers, you know, we didn't get into too much trouble, just kid stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you were a little girl and you have these three sisters that are similar in age and, mm-hmm. and playing together and these cousins in the city, mm-hmm. what were the kind of things you imagined that you dreamed about? What were your like childhood visions?
Yeah, well, you know, I think... If you talk to my sisters, they would tell you that I was always a dreamer. Mm-hmm. I think as a middle child, right, and my head is always in books and always in the stars, right, of what could be. And so I had I was always very much into the multicultural experience, I think, when I was a kid. So I had like a really menagerie of friends that I would bring to the house, and my friends and my family would be like, who and how did you meet these people always all my life? So I remember that as a very young child, bringing people home and, you know, people who were, because I was pretty pop. I've always been likable, right? Not popular always, but likable. And so I found that I always had a tendency to want to befriend the underdog. So those people in my classes, you know, in our class that other people didn't want to play with or something like that would be my friends, right? And mm-hmm. And because, you know, I was likable, you know, that allowed them a certain amount of security, right? It's weird kid stuff that they do, mean things to each other. And I was always the one sort of like, no, don't mess with her, she's my friend. And it's so funny. Or bringing home, one time I brought home this young man from school who said that his family was hitting him and beating him. And my dad was like, what do you want me to do? And I was like, he can't go back home, Dad. You know, like, he got to do something. Because he couldn't. I don't even remember how that ended up. But I think that I've always had a sense of fairness, right? And so in my childhood, I didn't, you know, it just made sense to me that everyone should be able to treat everyone a certain way. And I think that had a lot to do also with my upbringing, right, in the Christian church. Because before, you know, before you become a pubescent and before you become an adolescent, you know, they teach you about Jesus' love, right, during your childhood. All you learn about is, you know, how Christ was so loving and all these things that he did for these, you know, for different people who were pariah of society, who were, you know. And so that's what I grew up with, those stories I grew up on. And, you know, and I really embodied that and understood that, you know, that we should be treating each other a certain way and that certain things were unfair, right? Mm-hmm. And so, that's the only place I could remember getting that from, right? And also my parents, right? Because so my parents, as pastors and just really kind people, were always like taking people in. You know, we had families who lived with us at certain times. A lot of my cousins stayed with us through periods of time when there were struggles in their families. Different military men used to stay at the house, you know, And I think about that all the time, how many young men grew up with us. I have a lot of play brothers. They're all, you know, way older than we are, but they were, you know, there for us as young girls in the house and super respectful of my father. So there were never at a time where we had any issue around, you know, around sexuality. And that, which was, when I think back, was a really interesting thing. But not interesting because my dad commands that kind of respect because that's how respectful he is to others, right? Mm. So, and he would never put us in harm's way in that sense. And so we were blessed to have like this really safe community growing up, you know, that I feel like a lot of people that I've realized now is a blessing that a lot of people didn't have. And what came along with that also was the ability for us as young people to have friendships across gender lines, right? That, you know, as I got older, the more I would hear, you know, young people say like, oh, I don't have any boys and girls can't be friends, you know, guys and girls can't be friends. And I'm just like, that's the most absurd thing I've ever heard, because I've had friends all my life that are not in the same of the same gender as mine, and my cousins and I play cousins, of course. At some point, we're talking about that a few years ago, and they're like, that's because we had really safe spaces that adults made sure it was safe for us to be able to interact in a way that was comfortable, right? Mm. So that, you know, so that we were, you know, we were always in these situations within the church, within our church family, where boys and girls were together and adults were around us but letting us do our thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so we were able to be friends to each other. So friendship between the genders is not something that's challenging to me, right? It's something that comes easily. I think it's something that's natural, and that when it's cultivated in your community, that it's something that, you know, that is really beneficial for all of us. Mm-hmm. The concept around, you know, not having, not women and men not being able to be friends is just bizarre. So yeah, it's ridiculous.
What were some of your memories of schooling? I mean, you have, like, you have this amazing social sphere, this network of support and love and opportunity, and just, I mean, a really neat space to grow up as a child. What would then be the school life like?
Yeah, I know, right? What was school life? School sucked. I was really smart, but not really into school, right? I'm a middle kid, so I say I did anything that I did what I had to do just so I could pass. I never really was aspiring to do any, you know, I wasn't competitive at all, you know. I just wanted to read books, right?
What kind of books did you like reading?
Little kid books, so like Judy Blume back in the day. I'm dating myself, but I did tell you already how old I was. So Judy Blume and things like that, Green Worms, How to Eat Fried Green Worms, and, you know, just fun stuff, you know, fun kid stuff. Yeah. And sci-fi, like a little bit of fantasy, right? I've always read fantasy books, and that stopped, of course, when I started liking boys. So all the reading stopped in junior high school until college. And so school was something that was just there. I think that for me, because when I think back, I can't even remember teachers' names. Mm-hmm. Like, it was so like not really a huge part of my life. What I do remember most is that one of my best friend's father was a teacher, and they were black, and there was a black family, so it was a big deal that I had we had a black teacher in the second grade and also in the fourth grade, and you know, at the time in the suburbs as it was, that, and they were both really present in the school for those of us who were black students. And so I never felt like a lot of tension in my school with regards to race, because we had these really strong black figures in the elementary school that I went to. So junior high school was more of a mix, because then in the suburb where I live at, we have little community groups. So there's like a section, right? We have sections of town. So Willenboro, people live in Buckingham, Twin Hills, Pennypacker, that kind of thing. And each section had their own elementary school. Mm. So that folks from those elementary schools went to the same, sort of intermixed, and went to
junior
high. Right. Mm. So then at junior high, like, everything changes, right? So then it's like, you know, your world opens up. It's no longer just your block. It's, you know, all these other people. And then things definitely got crazy. friendships, I think, you know, with wanting to, you know, the people that I hang out with are different, you know, wanting to find new social groups, you know, and then feeling bad about leaving these other social groups, you know, that, and then junior high school, you know, the period of growth that young people are going through in our time is about identity, right? Mm-hmm. So, just trying to find myself in this large group of, you know, people that are new in my life wasn't interesting. And then also being able to make friendships with people that I had just peripherally known through, like, maybe social activities around town, right? And then, oh, now I can be friends with, so that my very best friend now, I met in the fourth grade through my elementary school friend, and then we became solid best friends in sixth grade, right? Mm-hmm. In junior high, when we were able to spend more time together because we're in school together.
Yeah.
You know, outside of school, you know, you're still just hanging on your block, and folks who are in your church, right? You don't get to go out. So it was a time when we were able to, like, start riding our bikes and go to other parts of the city, you know, the town, not a city, to the city and experience other people, what was happening in their lives around there. And
what did that experience do for you?
Yeah, I think that opened up the possibilities of, like, sort of what I feel like I could attain, right? You know, like, even just the riding of the bike, right? Like, being able to ride your bike off of the block was, like, a big deal. You know, your whole world opened up. My whole world opened up, the possibilities of where I could go, right? What I could do for my 3 hours after school before I had to be back home was a whole lot more adventurous than it was, you know, when I had to just be on the block for those 3 hours. So I think it gave us a sense of adventure. My sisters and I, we rode our bikes. My younger sister and I were closer. And so we did everything sort of together. Our family just made us do everything together anyhow. So, you know, everything we did, we couldn't do alone. We had to do en masse. So if it wasn't me and my sisters and my cousins, and we just had to do everything. And that stayed with us until we graduated high school. So everything was done in group situations. So I've been working in collectives, I feel like, my entire life, because we had to do things in groups. Fortunately, my daughter, who's she's her own child, I used to be like, well, you can't go until you find some friends. She's like, Mom, I won't go nowhere because you keep trying to hold me to the same standard that your parents did. And I don't have people like that in my life. And I'm like, you should though. Okay, go. So I really had to understand that, okay, that was my experience and that's not for everyone, but it kept us safe, right?
When you were going on these adventures and your world is expanding, but you're doing this in mass with your community and the people you care and are with, what was your role? What kind of role do you think you played in those groups?
Right. So I think about that a lot because I do a lot of soul searching. So I imagine I'm a fire sign. I'm a Sagittarius. I'm a fire sign, so I have a lot of fire in my sign. And I'm also a middle child, right? So I have this, you know, this sort of, I was never pushed to be a leader, but I found that because I have a lot of passion. I've been put in situations of negotiation. So I think when I was a kid, I thought I was like the negotiator, right? I was the ultimate communicator. Like, okay, we can talk about this. You know, that was my role all the time. I was the mediator between parties. That was my role forever. So yeah. That was my role.
Yeah.
Definitely.
When you made the transition from junior high into high school, was it still the same community?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So from when you first left that community, that was after high school.
Yeah.
Tell me what high school was like. What are some of your memories from that?
Yeah, high school was a lot of cutting. So I didn't go to high school.
What
much.
Kind of stuff were you up to? What were you rather doing?
Smoking weed, drinking. That was it. I would rather not be doing work. I was into boys. You know, I wanted to be into boys. And that it was a very at high school I had a very dualistic experience, right? So I had my church life and my church family, and I had my school friends and my school life, and none of the two should meet. Like, even my friends from church wouldn't like hang out with me in high school because I had my little, you know, popular group of friends, and they didn't really fit in that group of friends. So
did they all still go to the same high school? Went to different social spheres.
Yeah, it was interesting.
How did you balance these two worlds?
Well, you know, it just happened effortlessly. I don't think it was ever, you know, it never came up, you know, in my social group. At church, you know, they were ever like, why don't you play with us at school? Never. And, you know, I think that they just, I think they were probably intimidated by the girls I was hanging out with anyhow, so they were just like, I'm probably not going to be with those girls. And they were cool with us being, I think that I have the ability of always to make people feel comfortable around me. And so no matter when I spent time with people, they were happy in that time, right? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like, they felt neglected by me in school because I spoke to them, of course. It wasn't like I was just like, I'm not speaking to you in school. It wasn't a mean girl thing. Mm-hmm. It was just that we had different groups of friends. And a lot of that, too, was because if you think about it, we were all, it might have been different elementary schools anyhow, so we already had different bodies of friends in school than we did outside of school, mm-hmm. right? So it just followed through to high school where we were all together, you know what I mean, in this one space. So, yeah, so I realized that I had this sort of dual life, and it went on years in my 20s because I realized that I separated everything in my life because I sort of grew up like that. That continued on into my adulthood, and keeping my friend group separate, right? And that, you know, if I work people, work friends were not the same thing as home friends. Home friends were not the same as religious, you know, or spiritual friends. And so, and I wasn't really keen on mixing that till I think about 10 years ago when I started to really evaluate that for myself and think about and start moving in the way that my work it was very much about my life, right, and the things that I love, a life. And so now I'm able to like do work. The work that I do is it's very much informed by my lifestyle. So, you know, I work in environmental issues because the environment is everything about my spirituality. And so it makes sense for me to do this work. And so it makes sense that my friends who do this work as well will have the same interests as me in the social world. Mm-hmm. So now I have friends who I work with, right? And allowing myself to have that, it was a big deal for me. Mm-hmm. It was challenging for me to integrate that.
In high school, when you had these two different, when those social spheres first evolved, what was it that each sphere was giving you? Mm-hmm. What was it you were having met? What needs were being met? By
Yeah,
those
well, and I think that, you know, being in the growing up in the church, but also having this really this sense that there's so much more than just that. Even at a young age, right? Like, you know, I really thought that there was more to life than just this.
What do you mean by more than?
Well, because the religious institutions are sort of all-encompassing, right? So everything you get, you're supposed to get. Everything you need, you're supposed to get from the church. And so, and that I was, you know, and that wasn't true for me. And I knew that wasn't true for me. So I knew that I had to get those other things from outside of this, you know, the spiritual sanctuary, right? Mm-hmm. Of religious context and dogma. And I think that is I've started feeling like the like something is missing very much in junior high school with regards to my religion and what I needed for my wholeness as a being, right? Mm-hmm. So I dabbled. I would imagine that's what I at the time would call it, right? You know, dabbled in some secular some secular activities. My parents were actually really cool. My mom was very much because she didn't grow up in a church. She actually decided that she was going to go to church at some point, and she and her sister started going on her own to, like, you know, the church that where she met my father, which is evangelical, a lot different from the Baptist church that her mom went to, you know, where you just go to church on Sunday.
So it's your dad's like an evangelical pastor?
Yeah, he's Pentecostal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's a very different, you know, experience, right, in the evangelical tradition than it is in, like, a Baptist tradition. And way more is expected of you than in the Baptist world. So she, you know, chose that life of her own, but she always felt like my mother always felt like those folks who grew up in the church in a very strict way, always when they were left, like after they left those homes, their homes or whatever, they would wild out. You know, mm-hmm. They would just wild out because they had been so so repressed for so long that when they left out of that, you know, they were able to. So she was really clear with my father, who grew up in church all his life, that we would be able to have some secular experiences so that we wouldn't feel like, you know, we had been isolated as young people. And so we were, you know, so I was allowed to, right, experience and experiment in all these different ways. Mm. And as the middle child, I was sort of, they were sort of like, you're the only one who wants to do these things or that does these things, and it's only you. But I was just like, okay, whatever. It's, you know, I was the most inquisitive of my sisters, so it just made sense that I would, you know, go looking and searching for other things. Mm. My dad, you know, I was always just a curious child, so, you know, I was expected for me to do things a little bit differently than, because that was my, you know, personality, mm-hmm. I guess. Yeah.
When your sister, how much older is your oldest sister?
So my sister, older than me, she's 2.5 years, and my sister younger than me is 1.5. So we're about we're all 2 grades apart, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we say 2 years apart, but she's a little bit older than me.
So when you were in high school, and mm-hmm. she's about to finish high school, what was the expectation for the next step of your lives as young women?
Yeah, well, we were always going to college, all of us. So, you know, it was sort of like what you did after high school. It wasn't because my mom and dad went to school. My dad went to Lincoln, he did, but he left to go get married to my mom. So, so he didn't finish school then. He did go back later on and finish his degree. And so it was just, you know, common sort of expectations for us to go. It was really cool when my sister went to school first, because then we were able to visit her at college.
Where did she end up going to school?
She went to Stockton State, which I went to do after her. She went to Stockton State until she transferred to Delaware State, because she was a ball player and she had to get to a title, whatever school. I don't really know the whole thing, but she went to go to a better basketball division school. But then she messed her knee up, so she just finished out. And my younger sister actually went to community college, so she stayed with my parents. She lived with at home until she was 30-something, until she got married. Mm-hmm. The traditional way, apparently. That's what they say. So,
is it?
Yeah, I know. That's what I keep saying. I was like, is that what it's called? I didn't know. I missed that class.
I'm glad I missed it.
I was cutting. So yeah, I just left as soon as I was finished. You know, when I went to college, I never went back. So not until I actually was pregnant, I went home for a little while I was pregnant to stay with my parents. And but I was never coming back home. I
think so you knew you wanted to leave.
Yeah,
Where did you go?
Anywhere. So I went to school at Stockton, which is near Atlantic City, and down there in Atlantic City for the first 2 years. I went to a lot of different colleges. Actually, I had a fun time. So after that, I went to the University of Maryland.
Did you go to Stockton in part because your sister was there?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it was what we knew. We didn't know a lot about college, how to get into schools and stuff like that. We had already forged relationships there, that kind of thing. And also, I didn't have the best grades, so it was like, okay, go to a state school, get your grades up so you can go somewhere else, which is why I transferred 2 years later to the University of Maryland, which is a huge school, and it was like, well, and that didn't go well. So all my friends were at Howard. And so I would just, like, stay at Howard all the time. And it's a school, and the big, giant 40,000 people on campus thing was way more than I bargained for. And then my parents were like, okay. So I didn't do so well there. And my parents were like, okay, so come on home. And then I went to Glassboro. So I ended up going to, which is now Rowan University. That was the year I was graduating was the year they were switching over to Rowan, actually. And so, so I did a lot of school and stuff. And in college was fun. I just had a bunch of fun, which I really am under the impression, like, I really fully feel that college is about personal experience, not really about what you're learning in the classroom. So it's who you meet during school. It's who, the parents who help you get jobs when you get out. It's the relationships you have with your professors or the recommendations that you get that you need and when you get a job and move forward. So, it's not really about the schooling because you're not really learning things that you can apply later on in life. In college, it's an experience as an adult with no responsibilities. So it's the most fun you'll have as an adult. And I took advantage of that to the fullest advantage of that. I drove up and down the coast, went to all the HBCs I could, HBCUs I could, every historical black college I could go to, a party that I did. I met lots of people and did amazing things.
Tell me about the experiences of the HBCUs.
Yeah. Oh wow.
I've heard Ta-Nehisi Coates talk about Howard as the Mecca.
Yeah.
And I love that imagery.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that.
I love reading that. I was like, yes, it really was. It was like, this place where all these beautiful black people were, and they're all, smart and thinking about things and going places. And it was it was nestled in this huge chocolate city that, was black people everywhere. So it was awesome for me, to go there all the time. My best friend was there, so I was there all the time. I have friends still from Howard who think I went to school there because that's how much I was there. Like, wait a minute, you didn't go to Howard? I'm like, yeah, no. I was just there I stayed out there a summer, it was good times. But yeah, it was definitely, having this safe space, right? This historically black college as a safe space for black folks to come together and be free, right? And practice what it is to be free is a big deal, right? Having the resources and the support, maybe through faculty or whomever, to behind your ideas and your dreams. And, at the time, when my best friend was in school, Puffy was in school there. So they were, they were just entertainers, who now are these big people, I met one of my cousins there, and he's eventually formed Digable Planet. So, we had, all these people at the time who were thinking in these really forward ways about how to move, forward in entertainment, rather in all these different ways. Ras Baraka himself, not his son, his father, was there at the time. So, it was the 90s, and it was the era of De La Soul and the Native Tongues, and so we were all, thinking about, metaphysically thinking about things and building on ways as we partied, into the daylight. So it was great fun, and a lot of learning and a lot of political learning, right, and understanding our position, our situation, and watching people grow as we move forward.
Can you tell me a little bit about that? So you've talked about this childhood experience that was really diverse and not a real strong sense of discrimination or oppression in that childhood space that was this safe space. And then funneling into a junior high, more and more perspectives and communities coming together. eventually emerging as a person who has a real strong sense of self mm-hmm. and the roles of justice in the community that you're a part of. Tell me about that transition of that, those realizations. When did that sort of, when did those realizations come to you?
Yeah, I think that when I look at, when I think about the progression of the human development, right, I think that during you know, when we get to our later teen years is when a lot of us start dissecting institutional racism, right? So, you know, you were brought up, and so for me, you know, being brought up in this radical Black tradition, you know, I had heard and understood to some degree, right, what that was, but then, you know, when you go to college, you get that sort of book learning and really digging into, you know, because I took like every single African-American history class I could take, every single one, in all the schools that I went to, and so, you know, understanding it in an institutional way is just like really hard, right? And it really hits hard that, damn, this shit is going on, and it's going on like this. And you know, you had heard the experiences talked about, you know, but when you understand it to be this systematic thing, it just is a whole lot deeper. And so the anger, I think, that comes with a lot of young people at that age, because I think that's when a lot of us figure out the institutional barriers that are put or that are in play that affect our lives during that period of time, you know, between 18 and 21, mm-hmm. And so because I've watched it, you know, in other people as life is going on, just, like that is just a very, you know, real period of development for understanding those things, and then people are angry in all these different ways, you know, because of the truth of our existence, mm-hmm. right, in this society, and so yeah, it was, you know, definitely was, you know, and why like I would gravitate right to this more radical Black spaces of people instead of like maybe more the multicultural thing. So when I first went to Stockton, I had a friend note to me, and she was in my gospel choir, and she said, Trini, you just have like such an, like, I just see you have so many friends, so many different, she has such a diverse body of friends, like every time I come through this hall, I see you with a different group of people, and none of them are the same, and you just like, you know, so I don't have a problem, you know what I mean, intermixing with other folk. I never, you know, saw that as an issue, but what, you know, but understanding my situation, right, means that, you know, sometimes I move myself into spaces of comfort because it's necessary, right, for me to have security, for me to stay balanced, for me to get validation, right, for my experience in certain ways. So those Black spaces were important and necessary for me. My parents didn't want me to go to Black college, right, so I wasn't able, which, interesting enough, you know, it's like the Black schools get a bad rep, which is so not the experience that, it's, you know, it's sort of like the one story thing, you know, and that, you know, this dominant narrative says that, you know, Black schools, they party too much, you know, you won't get anything done, oh, it's not like the real world because you have to interact, you know, we're integrated now, you know, but the reality is all of my friends that went to HBCUs are all hella successful right now because of having that grounding, right, amongst, in that safe space to be able to believe in themselves and the people around them who look like them and encourage them to do things in a way, in a certain way. So my daughter is at an HBCU because of that, and because I just watch, you know, all of my friends that went to Howard, all of my friends that went to Hampton, all of my friends, they are all successful today, mm-hmm. right? And those of us who went to, you know, who struggled along in these in white, majority white schools, you know, and had these really racial experiences, and that caused us to challenge our identity, we're still able processing those things after the fact. So I feel like, you know, that during that time of period of growth for, you know, of development, personal development, that those safe spaces are really necessary because of what you're unpacking during that time, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you don't have that, it's a really different experience of growth growing up, and then you'll be struggling after to find that a little bit before you can move on, you know, depending on what kind of support you have in place. Mm-hmm. So I think that was, you know, that was really good for me to have those, you know, to search out in those spaces and have those spaces of development for myself and mm-hmm. be able to talk to people about, you know, openly about certain things. So, yeah.
When did you, so having these spaces of self-fulfillment, but also a fire, mm-hmm. What did you do with the fire?
Mm-hmm. Party. I danced everything away, you know, mm-hmm. not everything away, but I think it's, you know, very cathartic for me. And in the sense that I understood that, you know, I'm hugely a dancer. So, like, that was part of what I did as my release, right? Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of activism. So, you know, I was very much, you know, And I would say, am I a couch activist now? People talk about it the way people talk about it, like not as much as it wasn't as active as I thought I was at the time. You know, at the time you feel like you're doing all kinds of things as you're sitting around talking about these, you know, doing these things and making these moves with people that you never really moves that you never really made and just talked about. So, you know, I felt like activism at the time, very much not active, but verbal activism, I would imagine it was. So, you know, I don't think that yeah, just dancing would be my relief at the time. I don't think that there was other release than that. I wish there was, but no. Right after school, though, I think that that the radical, like the radicalness that was a part of my life for a long time, wasn't completely fulfilling, and so, and that's when my relationship with nature began.
Well, tell me more.
Yeah, so about two or three years after school. After college,
where did you go after? So after what became
Maryland,
Rowan?
Glassboro, right? No, Rowan.
And then that was it. The next step.
So I didn't graduate from Rowan, but I walked. Mm-hmm. I was like, I had three more classes to take, which I never took, and then ended up graduating years later. So I went back to school for in my 30s to finish my degree. But I was like so much done with school. My parents were like, oh, we're not paying for not one more class. And I was like, okay, well, I'm done anyhow. So.
Where did life take you from then?
So then I'm back to Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. You know, we mostly go to the places, the city that's closest to our childhood, right? So I live with my cousins here in Philadelphia. And
where in Philly?
In Mount Airy. Mm-hmm. In Mount Airy, yeah. Uptown, that's what they call it now. Mm-hmm. And so, and my cousins had a house, and they're my age, but their mother, who's also my cousin, they're my second cousin, mm-hmm. she had passed away, so she left them the house, so they had a house. And we all sort of lived there at some point, right? All of the cousins lived there at some point. And I stayed with my cousins there for a couple of years before I got my own place. And I was here in Philadelphia, you know, in the sort of, and I'd say all the time, the party kid scene, you know what I mean? We just went to clubs and stuff like that, sat around with my homies and talked about, you know, black righteousness and, you know, different, we studied, you know, Dr. Malachi York and different black leaders at the time who were present, you know, the Nations of Gods and Earths. Not a metaphysical, more metaphysical knowledge and different, and that was really futuristic, right? In this thinking of, you know, of ourselves and our, who are our ancestors and who are we connected to and who are, and who in our second, you know, and this is our, you know, our third time being here and, you know, how many times we've been on this planet and, you know, how we've grown in that person and who we were in a different life. And sort of that, and that we came from this planet here and this star here and that star gave us this, you know, and I got my daughter's name from the Nimulish, which is like the oldest text ever found in the world. Hmm. It comes from Babylonia, in Syria. So, you know, so we were studying, you know, we were studying all kinds of things.
What's
about
your daughter's name?
Enlil. Mm. Yeah. So she comes from the different story of Enki and Enlil, which is a Sumerian Babylonian text. Story of creation story, actually, which is called the Enumulish. And that was found in like the 1920s, so that was like this big, you know, deal that they had found this text that was like the oldest text ever found, and it had this creation story, and the creation story is very much and very similar to a lot of the other creation stories that we have. And so we had a lot of black scholars who had came out through the 70s and the 60s who were unpacking, you know, a lot of this African history for us. And so we're reading about, you know, all these things that, you know, that went against what we were taught that Africans did and Africans knew, right? And during that time. And so, you know, and that went along with, so the schooling, I think the education that I learned in high school and college through reading, college, not high school, couldn't do a lot of learning in high school, was, you know, was the textbook, like, you know, the African-American experience, right? And so on our own, we sort of experienced and explored the African experience, right? And then also the African alien experience, right? And thinking about ourselves as more than just these human beings, right? But like in cosmic beings, right? And what is our place in the cosmic, you know, thing, in the cosmic way of life? And so, yeah, we were definitely, you know, kids that were thinking about, you know, ourselves as stars and understanding ourselves to be, you know, star people. And that, you know, our existence was not just this thing that we know as life right here, right? And this everyday life, and that there was something way more to life than just our experiences with each other every day. And so when I think about my, so then that sort of informed and pushed me to explore more around cosmology and cosmologies and what sort of and who we are as universal beings, right? And how we came to this earth And what are we supposed to be doing when we're here? So then the ultimate question of why are we here is like, what's guiding me next?
I love hearing this. How did that, this new sense of the cosmic connection, mm-hmm. how did that square with this evangelical yeah. upbringing? Right. Was that still a part of your life too,
yeah.
that social sphere?
No, so right. So I had to, So that was the
The divide
conflict.
Is still there.
Yeah, that was the conflict that came. So, you know, when I was about 21, I guess, when I was 19, I knew that I didn't want to do religion anymore. But of course, you know, it's my foundation. So I had a very long battle with understanding how to walk away, right? But I did, and
how did it play out with your father?
It's still playing out, my friend. still playing out. So you know, I'm an adult. I'm not home, so there's not a whole lot they can do about that. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? It's just like, you know, so they just question me constantly about, you know, and they're thinking, oh, she's in a backsliding state. You know, first I'm backsliding, then it's like, you know, actually this is my way of life. You know, that 15 years later, I'm like, and it's the way of my child's life. And then 30 years later, it's like, okay, so this is me. Can you please accept it? But it's, you know, so it's an ongoing battle, most definitely. Mm-hmm. and for me inside it, internally, it was an ongoing battle. There were things that I saw as a child that were hard to dismiss. So, you know, I've seen people possess the demons. I've seen people who've had demons taken out of them or whatever they call it, exercise, mm-hmm. right? I think for me, that was those were the hardest things for me to tackle. So I wanted to know, there were certain things that I just was like, okay, so how do we explain this, right? Like, I saw this happen, and so what is the explanation of that? And that guided my learning experience, right? And trying to understand energy, right? And how energy coalesces in this world, and how it manifests, and how we manipulate it, and how it can be manipulated. With just thing we're talking about energy, but this is like real, like really just thinking about that in my 20s, in my early 20s, about energy, and then my learning and understanding of energy helped me to process what I saw in a way that made sense, I think, you know, scientifically, and, you know, and not just so, you know, not in a mystery way, right? Not in this mysterious, like, you know, oh my God, there's these demons and there's these, you know what I mean? Just understanding things as energy helped me a lot to understand, you know, what I had experienced growing up. And then it put a lot of language to other experiences, too, that I had growing up. I mean, my understanding of energy and how energy works and how waves work and how all of that really explained away a lot of the things that I found that I thought or saw as mysterious when I was growing up. Mm.
Mm-hmm. You talked about this time being in Mount Airy, moving back to Philly, mm-hmm. being there as also a time of your sort of environmental awakening.
Yeah.
Talk to me about how that cosmology and the sense of energy moving through the world in this time in your life was, and that place maybe
right.
even. I mean, you're close to the Wissahickon.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a tree-rich area.
Yeah,
tell me about this kind of environmental awakening in the midst of this spiritual awakening.
Mm-hmm. So as I was studying, so my studies, you know, were very metaphysical in nature. I guess after a while, stopped being as nourishing for me because they were also really patriarchal, right? They were men. They were texts that or philosophies that came from black males, but were very patriarchal. And so for me, even in the church, and my whole thing was always sort of like, where are the women, right? So where am I in this story, you know? And so so inevitably, I say, Jesus introduced me to his mother. And so I found, I think one of my girlfriends gave me this book, The Great Cosmic Mother, right? And which is like the Bible for all of us earth worshippers. And that was my introduction into sort of this world of the goddess, right? And so that put a lot of grounding to the metaphysical stuff that I was dealing with, that I was researching and studying. And
what do you mean by grounding?
Right, that's what I was gonna say. So I think that that the context, so the reality of as above, so below is really, really evident and clear in so many ways. And so what I was reading, in The Cosmic Mother was very similar to what I had been reading in these other contexts, but it was very, very enriched with this feminine understanding of it in an earthly way, right? Whereas the other things that I was reading was very universal and male and in a cosmic way, right? So I saw it as an extension of, right, like the below and you know, like these things here that are mirroring these things here, and that I actually resonate more with the earthly way of understanding these same concepts, right? than the cosmic way, because the cosmic way for me was felt really heady, felt not grounded in the earth, and I felt like, you know, this is where I exist, right? This is what I know. Then what that teaching should be able to be applied to my earthly experience, and so I found that in the text, in the expression of the goddess, right, in the religion of the goddess, and so that is sort of like, that was how that happened for me, and looking for this place, because, you know, even the folks that I was building with were mostly men, right, and you know, so understanding the dynamics just within our, you know, our study circles and our study groups was like, okay, there has to be something other. And so when I started reading more things about the goddess and/or the religion of the goddess, and sort of understanding the earth structures, right, and how earth energies are manifested, it spoke so much to me that I knew that it was where I was supposed to be going. So it was just like, okay, this is the path that you should be on, and that separated me actually for a while from my black sort of radical spaces, right? Because it wasn't, no longer was I studying things that black folks were studying so much. So I didn't know at the time any black women who were really into that. Just a few of us, actually. I have a few friends there from California, of course. You know, those West Coast people who always got their heads in the cloud. So it was a solitary journey. I had one good friend of mine, and she was a white woman. And she and I, like, you know, raised our kids together pretty much in the woods. And they bought some land, like, maybe 2 years after that. She and her husband, who was her boyfriend at the time, bought some land upstate New York. And this was 21 years ago. And we started camping, you know what I mean? And going to festivals, music festivals, and just, like, having these experiences in the woods. I had my child first, my daughter first, her children are younger than mine. But
tell me about becoming a mother. Was this around the same time?
That was 26. So now I'm at like age 26 and like 2 years into my, you know, sort of transition into my goddess, my environmental sort of goddess, earth worship, and studies. And so, yeah, that was 26 when I had my daughter, or when I got pregnant, and 27 when I had her. And she was amazing. And during the process of being, you know, of carrying her and birthing her, I was like, oh, the black woman is God. So I knew almost like, now I know that women are God. Like, why and how did anyone say anything different from this? I will never believe that. How they got to that must be some mind compelling, you know, spell on men that says that, because anyone that can understand this process will understand that this is truly an act of miracle,
of creation,
right? Of creation. And wow, like, so yeah, that being, you know, being pregnant, growing something inside you, like, just the whole thing is just, you know, mind-blowing to me, how amazing it is and how blessed I was to be able to carry a person, right?
Yeah.
And to fruition, and to, yeah, the creation thing is real.
Did you become a mother while living in Mount Airy?
I was in North Philly. By this time I was in Northern Liberties, before it was like the
before it all got gentrified,
before it all got
all the breweries came
right in the beginning of the gentrification. Yeah, so I was there at that time. So I was in and out of North Philly by that time. I was only with my cousins for that first 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so then motherhood happened, and the you know, the experience that I was having religiously, spiritually, right, not religiously, spiritually, was very much embedded in just earth worship. And we had, and I think that also what I was studying with my within my black circles was very much about earth, you know, naturalness, right? So it's, you know, it's a very black natural, you know, it's the natural movement, right? So we were all about, you know, doing black natural things. And so, you know, so I thought, you know, part of that was, you know, what's nature, actual nature, not just natural hair, natural, you know, looking clothes, but like nature. And I'd be like, let's go to the, you know, and they'd be like, yeah, no, I'm not really trying to go to the woods. I'm just saying we want to live a natural existence. So we had all these talks and these conversations about, you know, living in the woods and on our own, and you know. And
had you ever done that before? I mean you grew up in the suburbs, and we had to, like, yards, but woods
never,
and stuff?
Never. Well, we had woods when I was growing up, like little pockets of woods that we would explore into. Absolutely. You know, it was all about exploring in these little natural, in the creek. We catch tadpoles and shit, but never ever. Like, my parents, when I first took my daughter to camp, was like, you're going where? What is going on now?
Where would you go?
Up to my girl, my friend's land.
Oh, so when they bought that place in New York.
Yeah, we just started camping there.
That was the
go-to. Yep, every year. So we camped every year, sometimes two or three times a summer, you know what I mean? And there, outside of there, we go to festivals, music festivals, where you camp out, mm-hmm. you know, for the weekend or whatever. And so, yeah, that was an interesting, you know, turn. And a lot of my friends weren't into it. So that's sort of the separation, was really not necessarily about the change in what I was studying, but more so about the fact that I wanted to be in these spaces. And they were like, yeah, but I'm not really trying. I'm not ready for that yet. You know what I mean? So, you know, I focused on camp and that kind of thing, you know, which is so untrue. Now I'm very blessed to have this huge, enormously beautiful group of black folks around me who are all about natural spaces and all about camping and all. So that, you know, just had to happen. It had to be, you know, it's timing, right? Mm. At the time, the folks that I was hanging out with weren't down with that. So, you know, so we separated because of that, and because of other things, I'm sure. We got old. I got pregnant. So once I had my child, all of my priorities changed, right? Mm. So it didn't make, you know, my priority wasn't hanging out at the club, sitting around my homies and chit-chatting and talking about the, you know, philosophizing about the future. I was like, okay, I have to take care of this, you know, this little being who's counting on me for, you know, for daily life. And so, yeah, so my priorities shifted.
How? Tell me about how.
As a mother? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, it was about how do I put food on the table, right? How do I make sure that she has a space that is comfortable and is safe, right? So, you know, my living, you know, where we lived was really important. Making sure that I was working consistently was really important. Making sure that she had, like, the most experiences that she could possibly have to fill her head with all things imaginable was really important to me. So she was everything, actually, to me forever. You know, I didn't have space in my head for anything else. And I made that commitment because I was just so in awe of who she was. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yes, nothing else matters but her. So that's just how that went for a long time.
Yeah.
She was connected to my hip.
Tell me about how you merged the spiritual awakening, the new kind of social connections you're starting to make, but also motherhood with your work life.
Yeah.
I mean, when did those things start to become more synthesized?
Well, work, actually, so in my late 20s, after I had my child, so I've been maybe 2 years into, you know, she was about two and her toddler years, I did a real, you know, a real search, so soul searching of, like, sort of what makes me happy, what do I want to do in life? Really because I needed to, you know, because I didn't have a career path, right? I went to school for communications. It's like, what is that? What do you do with that? So, and I knew I didn't really want to do communications. I didn't want to do PR, public relations, which is what I ended up sort of trying to focus on. But that was just, you know, too mired in this capitalist marketed thing that I was totally against. You know, I'm an anti-capitalist. So, and have been for a long time. So, you know, I was like, okay, what can I do? You know, I don't want to work. And because I did some temping, and so in the temping I was able to experience corporate America in these different ways, you know, just to see if this is what, you know, does that make sense for me? It very much could have been a marketing, whatever, because I have the passion, right, to do that thing, but not really, but feeling very uncomfortable with the field, right, and understanding that that's not, you know, that is not a part of who I am. Yeah. Like, I can't be.
Those aren't the interests you want to work toward.
Not at all, mm-hmm. Right. So I did a whole long soul search and looked back at my path and realized that actually I was most happiest when I'm in service to others. And so that was when I was about 28. And so then I realized, then I knew that, okay, so I'm going to stay in nonprofit work because this way I'll always be in service to others. So I just started, and that actually started off, it wasn't nonprofit work specifically, but I was doing, I was working with children with disabilities. So that is what, and that allowed me to work in the school so that I had the same work hours as my child. So that's what things that are important to me, that I'm home with my kid. She's not a latchkey kid. She's not going to after school programs all day long, all evening long, that she's in school for regular school time, and then we're home together. And so I didn't take a lot of other jobs or extra jobs, like some people thought, you know, I should have ever, whatever, because it's most important that she be with me, right? That I'm influencing my child's decisions and my child's development. And so, you know, I didn't make a lot of money at all. And in the summer times, I was off, right? Which means I had no money in the summertime, but I was out camping, so I didn't care. But somehow we were blessed and favored, and we still, you know, kept the house over our head. And eventually we moved upstate New York because I wanted to have my child grow up in the woods. Yeah, I wanted her to run freely and be free and feel free and not be bogged down by the by the things that young people in cities, you know, feel like they have to be hard, and the hard life of this city. Mm-hmm. I didn't want my child growing up like that. I knew I wasn't raised in a city. I didn't want her to be raised in a city. I was not taking her to the suburbs. So, and my, you know, everything that we were learning and living in was about the environment. So I wanted her to be growing, to grow up with this real visceral relationship, right, to Gaia. So, like, you know, like, let me just take her up there. So we moved up north.
Where'd you go up north?
We went up not too far from where the land was, right? So we had this whole plan. It was like a bunch of us and our eclectic group of people. And we were like, yes, we're going to do an exodus to the land, and we'll live on the land and eat and feed each other. And and so three families moved up, and we all moved to different counties, and we never saw each other again except for the same time that we would meet every year before that. So it's so funny. And even the people who had the land never moved up there. It was just like, we were moving to your land, and you're not moving up here. They were like, we're not ready yet. So we had amazing experiences on the land for so long, and we moved up to Oneonta, so that's right outside of where the land is that we would camp out all the time.
Oneonta?
Yeah, Oneonta. That we actually moved, when we first moved, we moved to right where the camp, where the land was, which was outside of Oneonta, which is this little tiny town, which had like a K-12 school, and that was like the worst racial experience ever. It was just the worst racial experience. It was just too much. I was like, okay, this is too much. Too much in the country. Let's just go ahead in the town.
It was all white folks. White rural.
Rural folks. Who act like they never saw black folks in their lives. Like, they wouldn't play with my kids at school. Like, little kids would tell her, like, we don't play with brown people. And she would come home with these stories, and I would be, like, bawling. Listen, she was so strong. She was in second grade, and she would come home, like, with her fist in the air, like, I am black and beautiful. I don't even know. I was like, I didn't even realize I had embedded all that in her. But she was so strong through all that. And I was, like, distraught, trying to hold myself together, like, tell me more. And then I was there every day, you know, like, what the hell? What the hell's going on? Because I'm hugely an advocate for my child. Mm-hmm. And so, and you know, especially because I worked in school, so I know how that works. If you're not there, they don't care about your kid, mm-hmm. especially if they're a child of color. And so I've always been a huge advocate and a proponent that that parents have to be advocates and be on, you know, at your school all the time for them to know that you care. Mm-hmm. If not, they treat your kid mediocre at best. And so the, you know, the teacher was sort of like, oh, I don't see a problem. I was like, okay, I got it. She got to go. So she's out of there within a month, and she went to the Montessori school, which is a better experience, of course, but very challenging for the teachers because my kid is pretty, you know, she's a fire sign too, and very opinionated. And they had this, you know, rule where kids can do whatever they want to, right? And if they didn't want to go to other things, they didn't have to, as long as they can explain themselves. So she explained herself out of everything and stayed in one corner the whole time and play in the play area. And they were like, so we think that you need to, and I was like, but you told her that she could do that. So unless you can make her do the thing. And they were like, we can't. I was like, well, then that's what you get. Of course, she's an amazing student, like literally has been an A student all her life. So that was not the issue. The issue is that they couldn't make her do anything because she could explain her way out of everything. This is why I want to be here. And it made sense, you know? It was like, she said to the guy in the second grade when they took his field trip to this church, and the preacher was saying how, you know, you need schools. Schools are the thing, because if we didn't have schools, people wouldn't learn. And she's like, well, then how did the first person ever learn? They were like, whose kid is this? So she's like, that's not true. I know that's not true. I learn all the time at home, you know? So she's pretty, she's just always pretty amazing. And it was a really, you know, for me, it was really challenging. So we left and moved closer to the city where we had friends at anyhow.
Which city?
In Oneonta. Mm. City, Oneonta. Mm. Not really city, but town, which was the college town. So that, you know, that was my upstate New York. I stayed in college towns because at least there's some kind of diversity, right? Mm. And Oneonta, there's very, very little diversity. But and what it was probably in the college. It was from the college, not necessarily in the town. But because there wasn't a lot of even like a small trickle of black folks, there wasn't a lot of visible racism, right? So I didn't experience a lot of any other. Like we had the most amazing 5 years in Oneonta. We just, you know, played music, and you know, had friends had land, and we stayed on the land, and we swam in rivers and waterfalls, and she just had, you know, amazing experiences. We just had so much fun there.
When you say stay in the land, what does that mean?
Camping out on people's land, people who have acres of land, and we just sit out and camp out for days and eat together and play music together and, you know, take care of each other and love each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's fun.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it's good times. We all talk back. We want to go back to Wildwood. My friend's land was called Wildwood. He had festivals there. It was good. They were all musicians, right, and artists. All of my friends, it seemed that later on someone had asked me, and I was like, I have really good friends who are white, and they were like, well, they must be all radical, and I was like, oh, you know, you're right. So they're all artists and radical in some way, right? In some way, they're definitely anti-establishment, right? So they weren't like your average white folk, you know what I mean? There are people who were really against, like, living in a certain way, in a box, right? Like, we're not going to live in a box. So, you know, my friends were carpenters and stonemasons and, you know, guitar players and singers, and it was good, you know, for a long time. But there was no... There was no school, like I couldn't make enough money in that town. It was just too small. Mm-hmm. There was no real industries there. Working in a nonprofit was cool, but not really fulfilling. And she was getting older, and she needed to be around more children who looked like her. So I thought that Ithaca was the next best place because, hey, there's brown folks in Ithaca, and they have a long-standing history of black folks there, and black and brown folks there. And so we moved to Ithaca from Oneonta, and that was like a complete change, because Ithaca is hella political. So we're in Oneonta, I didn't have any experience with the political, right? It was just about feeding my spirituality, feeding, you know, drum circles and women's sort of spaces and, you know, all these eclectic sort of, you know, cool, out-of-the-way things. And then all of a sudden it was like, wow, and I was like slapped into the, like, this is what's happening between white people and black people and Puerto Ricans, and everyone has an opinion. Everyone has bumper stickers. Never been to any place where the whole fucking place has an opinion, like, and you have to listen to a t-shirt say something, bumper stickers. It's like crazy. I couldn't go to the grocery store without people engaging me about, you know, issues. I was like, seriously, I just don't buy chips. So it was crazy, and very, very much an educational experience for me politically.
How so?
So it was where I needed to go. When I had moved upstate New York, I had this I had convinced myself that multiculturalism was the way forward, right? And that I wanted my daughter to grow up in this experience of having all these different, you know, people around her from different walks of life, right? I just wanted her to have this diverse experience, you know, that would bring her more of a full being to know and understand other people's plights along with her own. And, you know, in searching for that upstate New York, is like I was in a few different groups where we talked and studied, you know, we tried to be, you know, to create intentional communities because, you know, I was always still on my path to live in the woods, right? Mm-hmm. Like, let's create intentional communities. And we wanted to have these diverse bodies of attention, but the diverse was like me and my kid. I was like, we can't be what is diverse in this group. Like, it can't be the two of us and all white folks for the rest of my life. Like, that doesn't feed me at all. And so once I realized that, I stopped doing the intentional community thing until, you know, and I said to ancestors, like, until that comes to me, you know what I mean? I'm, you know, I know that this is what I want to do eventually, but until that comes to me, I'll leave that alone. You know, I'm not going to be searching for these groups that are, you know, living in the land on the, you know, in a way that's really cool. And so, we Ithaca was like, you have to, I had to participate. And I worked for a historically black community center, which I wanted to work for when I first moved there because I read about it. And it has this, you know, historically amazing story of, you know, when it was created by these black folks who lived in the South Side. And they're like, you know, folks who were planted there from the on the Underground Railroad. And it's just like such an amazing story. Yeah. And then I got there and they weren't really doing anything. And I was like, what's happening at the community center? And I was like, I want to work there. But I had this other job, the job that paid me a lot of money at the time for what I had been making at the time. And was more, you know, and was more stable, of course.
What was that job?
I was working for people with disabilities, getting them jobs. Mm. And I worked there for a year, and it was so boring and so like it didn't feed me at all. Like, I would fall asleep at my desk all the time. It's like, I can't believe I'm getting paid to do this. This sucks. Like, I don't want to just take money, you know, for, and even though the work was worthy, it wasn't enough of it. Mm. And it wasn't, you know, so I didn't feel fulfilled doing that. And it was boring the hell out of me. So I took a huge pay cut to take this job at the community center. But it was what I wanted to do. I wanted to work in that black community. I wanted to, you know, to change things. And so I did. And it was awesome.
What did you do?
Well, I was a program manager there, and we did a lot of stuff. So I was only in Ithaca for 3 years, but I feel like, you know, we did so much work. We started
Ithaca. When was this, like, years-wise?
This was in 2000, I'm sorry. It was in 2009.
Okay.
2009. I was there from 2009 to 2012
okay.
when I moved back here. And we started the Youth Farm Project when I was there. So that's when I got into food activism.
I was saying, yeah, when did the farm, for you talk about the land
yeah,
and
camping. Yeah,
right.
So I was on the land forever. I was experiencing the land and creating a relationship with the land. And, you know, very personal, very intimate relationships with the land while I was in Oneonta. You know, that just allowed me to open up this whole thing that I had, you know, put my theory into practice, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I've been studying all these things for a very long time, and then I was able to do a lot of practicing spiritually on the land and with the land, right? And so Ithaca was like, and, you know, even though I had, like, waterfalls down the street from my house, which is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
I was barely able to like participate in that too much because I was so politically involved.
Mm.
And that's because of seeing the situation, right? So I can't really, you know, just a part of who I am. When I, as I told you earlier, when I see injustice, it's like, what? This is not going down like that. So immediately I just jumped into what the community needed. You know, I just talked to people all the time. I talked to young people, I talked to elders, I talked to old people. Like, what do people need? What has happened before? What was the story before I got here? You know, what's the situation with the board? You know, so there's a lot of politics involved there. So I had to find all the answers, or not answers, get all this information so I can try to figure out, you know, what to do. And so lots of different work was accumulated during that period of time. We started the Black community leaders of color during that time that got started. We started the Youth Farm Project. There was a we started the Congo Square Market at the community center where I work at, which is an open air market for people of color to start entrepreneurial ideals.
Mm.
And we started a fresh fruit and vegetable snack program where we were able to provide a fruit and vegetable snack to two different schools that had the majority of students of color, like had the most students, not majorities, never majority of students of color, that had the majority, that had the most students of color and or the poorest schools, I guess, in the community, and were able to like introduce them to all these really good foods and stuff like that. And that's still going on. All these programs are still going on, which is really awesome to know that, you know, because that's always the worry when you leave a place. It's like, oh my God, will everything stop with me? Which
yeah.
is so funny that I even had that idea, but I'm so thankful now to know that, okay, you're tripping. And, you know, that's what planting
seeds is about.
You build
the foundation
and
it grows, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so those programs are still going on, and it's great. And then so Ithaca is like this microcosm of a city, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's considered a city, so it's, you know, designated as a city, so it moves in the same way that a big city would move. But because it's very small, you get to see a bird's eye view mm-hmm. of what happens. And so that bird's eye view is really it's really bad and mean, and it feels bad to know that this is how things play out,
mm-hmm.
right? When you can see them actuality, like actually just like here in Philadelphia, it's huge municipalities and all kind, and we're the seat, the county seat, and the, you know, there's all these different things happening that keeps us from actually seeing the mechanisms that create the divides and that create poverty and that create. But in Ithaca, you can see it really, really clearly. You can see why, you know, these folks aren't getting funding this way. Why? And that for me was like the hugest lesson. While I was there, the political situation and understanding how things trickle down
yeah.
and who's pulling strings was really, yeah, because I was able to be in those spaces. Like, you know the mayor, you know the superintendent of schools, you know these folks, you know, you see them at the stores, you have conversations with them, and you see how the politics work, and it's ugly, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I left because it was just too much on my child, actually. So she was getting to the age where her identity, you know, is being challenged in a town where Black folks are always the minority, in a town where the brown folks and Black folks who did live there have so many social agencies that they don't really understand the impacts, you know, of race in a way that, you know, that is informed, right? So there's no real political education mm-hmm. of the people there. There's, you know, certain people that, you know, and then there's this huge contingency of brown and Black folks who are trying to keep the status quo, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was way too radical for that city ever. I was always way too radical.
Philly needed you.
Right. I was way too radical for Ithaca. They're just like, you know, they got, you know, the colleges there, so we had the Black elite that you had to deal with, you know, and mm-hmm. so, and you have a huge group of like white hippies from the 60s who moved out there and started these social justice organizations to get, you know, so there's this codependency that's happening there that's just like so different from, you know, what I know, right?
So before we get, let's just maybe take a break here before we step into Philly and then thinking about Philly's future.
Guys, we got to do futures because what time is it?
Yeah. All right. Today is August 2nd. This is a follow-up interview. This is Roger Eardley Pryor. I'm here speaking with Katrina Baxter, and we are in Philadelphia on Benjamin Franklin Parkway. And the last time we met, Katrina, you had just spoken about moving from Ithaca, New York, to back to Philadelphia with you and your daughter and having a new experience here. So bring me up to date from when you moved here to Philly to what you're up to today. And what the city, what kind of things you're up to in the city today.
Right. So when I first moved back to New York, I was being vetted for directorship at one of the farms, the local farms here, Urban Ag Farms here. And that didn't work out. So that was more because that organization itself was sort of, was trying to get themselves together. So they they decided to just go like a whole other way from what they originally like, okay, let's fall back.
But you knew you wanted to do urban farm work when you came back.
I specifically knew when I came back to Philadelphia. Well, in Ithaca, I had worked across the gamut in different issues for the black community. And that sort of took me away from what I realized that I wanted when I realized that I wanted to work specifically environmental issues, right? Because, you know, remember, I think I mentioned that earlier, I sort of figured at some point that land is the basis of all of our ills, right? So so if I'm going to be fighting, like, sort of thinking about all the different things that, you know, I feel they're wrong, right? All the different injustices in the world, I thought my energy would be best served working through the environment, right? And this was, you know, and this was, I think I mentioned that the last time. If not, then that happened sometime in my early 30s.
Okay.
So when I got sort of wrapped up in so many things in Ithaca, I was like, okay, so that is not what I want to continue to do. I don't want to have my energy spread so thinly across the board because so many issues in our community need to be addressed that I can't fully address one thing, right? So I decided when I came back to Philadelphia that I was just going to work in environmental issues. Like, I'm just going to stay there. And also that I really wanted to work with black organizations. Like, I just, you know, it was a great thing that I was able to do that in Ithaca, and so I wanted to continue that, you know, working with black organizations. It was really challenging to find any, and then that's when I found out that there were really no black or urban ag orgs in Philadelphia, right? Not run by any black folks. And that the urban ag community here was pretty small and siloed, right? So organizations weren't really talking to each other a whole lot across the board, you know, with our nonprofit. It's sort of like, you know, that's our competition for grants, right? And so there's not a lot of impetus to work together organizationally unless the grant requires a collaboration, right? And so I think a lot of us feel like, you know, our organizations, you know, sort of required us to see each other as competition as opposed to, you know, friend as opposed to like alliances.
Yeah.
And those of us who work the land understand how very important we are each to each other, right? So, you know, the whole understanding how ecosystems and how ecosystems work and working in that field just gives you a really, you know, present, I guess, understanding of how connected we all are and how important it is for those connections to be there. And so for 2 years when I first got here, I think for a year and a half, I worked in doing parenting classes. So I couldn't find any work in urban ag, mostly because it was siloed and very much folks were hiring people that they didn't know who looked like them. And that was disconcerting for me because I felt like my resume speaks for itself. Like, why am I not getting callbacks? Why am I not? And where are the jobs? Like, where are they posted? Where, you know, who? How do people even find out? You know, so it was
And this is late 2000s.
Yeah, and this was late 2000s. Yeah, 2012. And so, you know, I volunteered at a whole bunch of farms around community gardens around my area. I got involved with the Peace Park. I got involved with the at the time it was right now it's Brewery Community Garden, Brewerytown Community Garden. At the time it was Marathon Farms, and those are both in my community, not too far from my house. Both of which Marathon Farms was started by a restaurant in North Philly, the restaurant was, you know, downtown, but they like got this lease to purchase this land in the middle of the hood, you know, to grow food for their restaurant and of course for the community too. So the interesting part about what I felt about that project was that what we usually look for in community gardens, and this is, you know, after a few years of researching and working nationally with other folks through Ithaca, was that, you know, when folks start, when white folks come into a community of color and start a garden, there's no buy-in, right? Because those folks didn't say, this is what I want. There's someone else from the outside coming in and telling them, this is what you need. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, across the board, nationally, those programs aren't really well received, and you don't get a lot of community buy-in. So you might have a whole lot of activities happening there, but it's not really, you know, engaged. The community isn't necessarily engaged in those. So that's always been an issue. That has been an ongoing issue within urban agriculture. And so with Marathon Farms, it was interesting to me because there's a young man, there's a gentleman on the block who totally, like, was like, what is this going on? You know, he lives next door to the farm. So he's like, what is happening? When it started happening, he, like, hang out with them the whole year, the first year they were there. Learned everything because he has, like, this ridiculous memory where he can remember everything. Literally learned everything they did in a year, right? And the next year was able to do everything that people had never grown before, right? So they were really excited, impressed, and they hired him, which is unusual, right? Because that's not usually how those things go. And then he was taking in, and so by the time I came, I think that was his second year, the end of his first season there. And he was telling me sort of his story. So I was helping him at the farm, at the garden there, and then I learned about the Peace Park, which wasn't too far from that. So I started volunteering there as well. And so I was just doing a lot of volunteers and gardening. And then one day I saw the job for the Law Center, at the time it was the Public Interest Law Center of Philadelphia, which is PILCOP. And
what is it now, officially?
We changed it to the Law Center, so that we took off the Philadelphia, because people were saying PILCOP instead of PILCOP. But now everyone still calls us PILCOP, so it's just so confusing. Transitions take a while. So when I saw the job, it was interesting because my thing is I didn't. You know, checking out, I had known a few of the organizations now. Like, I knew about UNI because I had some friends who worked there that I met at conferences nationally. I knew that was a large farm that was organized through a university, so I wasn't absolutely sure that was the way I wanted to go politically, understanding the dynamics between university and community and getting community collaborations and how challenging those are.
Where is the UNI farm? Is it over in West Philly or
Bartram,
up in North?
It's at Bartram Gardens.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They have a huge, beautiful farm in the back of Bartram Garden. And that was started with the University of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. So they were really well resourced, of course, you know, but had a very specific mission that was tied to University of Pennsylvania, not tied to the community, right? So the other job fell through. So I was doing parenting classes, and then I saw this job. And when this job came across, really, I saw Amy Lahr's name. And I had met Amy Lahr Khan, who's the woman that I work with, the attorney that I work with here. She just left, actually. She just left. Moved on to better things. But she and I had met a couple of years ago in a conference in California. I really liked her. She was sweet. She had good politics, right? We were in the conversations that we were having when we were talking about these things in Oakland. And then I met her again. Then we got reacquainted when I first moved back to Philadelphia. There was a conference out here. My friend Malik Keeney from Detroit was in town, and he and I went up to the conference, and she and I had a whole conversation then, too. This was a year before I moved back here, or a couple of months before I moved back. So when I saw the thing, and I remember saying, I'm going to reach out to her when I move here, right? Mm-hmm. I took a card, and I never did, or maybe I did once or twice, and we never really linked up or something like that. And so when I saw the job, I was like, oh, that's for me. That job is for me, you know? I had no idea what a public interest law center was, because who ever heard of a nonprofit law center? Unless you're like, really, I don't know. I just like never heard of that. So it was like, okay, I don't know really what this is, but I know that I respect her politics. And I know that that job will allow me to work across gardens across the city, right? I won't have to be just sort of loyal to one organization. I'll be able to work with all these different organizations and help them in these ways. And that was, for me, really advantageous.
When did that position open up?
And that was in the fall of 2014.
Awesome.
Yeah.
When you talk about the politics, what does that mean? Like, I've seen you speak before about this relationship when you work the land that creates both prosperity and encourages democracy. Mm-hmm. What are the politics that you're interested in doing this sort of land movement?
Right. Well, I think for me, when I was speaking about, I guess, Amy Lahr specifically, when I think about politics of white folks, right? So, you know, for me, and actually, you know, I think about it across the board. But when I think about it in relation to who I'm going to work with and who I'm going to, you know, like we say, throw down with, right, mm-hmm. in the movement, it's like movement terms. who am I to throw down with? And I need to know, what are your personal politics? What are you moving politically? And what do you stand politically when it comes to race and economics, right? Racial justice and economic justice, right? So racial justice, a lot of people will have an understanding of, right? So, and I think when I say politics, like an understanding of the real issues behind the situation, right? So what do you understand about the racial politics, you know, the racial situation for black folks and people of color and this, and where you stand in that, right, is really important to me. So if you don't have, you know, people that say they're, you know, I'm very much all about social justice, but you don't have a racial politic, right? You don't have a racial analysis, right? And then you may have, you know, then that's challenging. That's a problematic for me, right? So I don't want to be people who just want to do good, right, without really understanding the issues behind the systemic oppressions that affect us, right? Mm-hmm. So really, when I say politics, I'm saying people's understanding of the systemic ways that other folks are affected through our society, right? Mm-hmm. And so I understand that we all have, you know, there's a continuum. You know, some people are here and some people are here. If you look at it as like a metronome, so I choose to work with people who are a little bit more understanding and knowledgeable on their politic around race, right? Yeah. And gender, and that's really important to me. So Amy Laura, in that sense, had really good politics around race and gender. So she's someone I could work with, because then I don't have to be constantly explaining why these things are important, right? So that, because that's what happens if you're working with people who don't have a politic, then it's a constant education, right? Mm-hmm. Of getting people up to speed and understanding why we fight for these things and why these things are happening to our communities, and also also sometimes convincing them that these things are actually happening. Because a lot of people refuse to understand that this is our reality as black folks on this planet. Mm. So that's what I mean. And so when I saw the job, Amy Laura, it was there at the interview, and I just was like, this is my job. And usually that's how I get things, you know, I'm like, okay, I know this is for me. So, you know, I knew it was for me, but, you know, I had no idea what this whole thing was. It was my first time applying specifically as an organizer, right? Because I had said before that I didn't really understand, you know, I just do what needed to be done in my community. People are like, oh, you're an organizer. And I was like, okay, that makes sense. So now I was like, you know, understanding that is my role, right? And knowing what now at that time, understanding what an organizer was. It's like, oh, yeah, I can do that. I do that all day. Mm-hmm. So I started here, which was awesome. And you know, it allowed me to really, I think, in my role, because it's a law center, and because of Amy Laura's work before I got here, she's very respected in the urban ag community, because she has been championing like the causes of urban agriculture since she got into this role more than anyone before her, right? And across the nation, she's like the only full time lawyer working in these type of issues in the country, right? Wow. So she, you know, what she did here in Philadelphia was just like phenomenal. And so I was thankful to be a part of, you know, like this machine that was just, you know, getting started. And
can you tell me a little bit? So you mentioned earlier that you saw land as kind of the focal point for that brings together all these issues that are about justice, right, that are about the black community, that are about economic issues, that are about gender inequality, mm-hmm, and the systemic forces that encourage continued oppression of that. Mm-hmm. How does that all come back together for you in terms of agriculture, in urban agriculture? Mm-hmm. Why is that the connection point?
Right. Well, I think that for me, I think it first stemmed from, like, when I think about the history of the world, right? A lot of it we don't know, right? We just have this European history of this European understanding of what, you know, civilization is, quote unquote. And so, you know, if you look at the beginning of European history, a lot of what they, you know, all they talk about is fiefdoms and sort of, you know, their whole impetus for movement, their migration, was based on them needing land, right? Not being able to subsidize, you know, themselves in the place where they were, so looking to other places to get the thing. And so that sort of, so when you look at that, that's like everything stems from, right, this desire to have something that is not yours, which is the land, because the land is what provides you with everything that you need. right? And if you have land that is barren, then you don't have everything that you need. So land for me, understanding that, right, that everything comes from the land means that the land is most important, right? And so that so that when I think about the work that we do here in the cities with regards to urban agriculture and the act of taking over vacant lots and repurposing them for the community, you know, for community purpose is taking back, right, control, right, taking back power, right, taking back this this ability to sustain ourselves through the land, even though it, you know, it's on a small, you know, if you want to just look at it as a, it's just growing food, but for me, I'm looking at it in a very larger sense of power, right? Because understanding that that is what has guided this whole process all along, right? People's desire to have that land so that they can have what they need. And so that's sort of where that connects for me.
That's beautiful. Because the last time we spoke, you spoke a lot about your environmental awakening being also a spiritual journey.
Yeah.
And just wondering how these all of these things collide together in this one sort of environmental frame is really, I think that helps. It helps me understand.
Yeah.
It.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's helped. So one of the things I wanted to just make this really clear that with my daughter, so when we first moved here, the first year we were here, my daughter and I were driving in the car and we were having this conversation, and she says to me, "Mom, you know, y'all raised us, she says, y'all raised us. I'm thinking about those folks out there who raised us alternatively, right? You know, to understand these systems and understand, how unjust the system is. She's, you know, grew up in this with this very light alternative, like not what the average person or average family is, you know, discussing at their dinner table or things that we discussed about. And she's like, "But what are we supposed to do with that?" You know, so she was like, "I mean, so when I graduate from college, you know, I'm going to college. When I graduate from college, what am I supposed to do? I can't, you know, knowing the system as it is, how could I rightfully go into this workforce, right? And expect to contribute in these ways in the system that we're not down with." And that was like a moment for me that I keep that. I hold that as my charge, right? For my child to create something for the future. And so since that day forward, I've been working towards building a future for my child, right? So where does she go when she comes out of school? It's really important to me where her friends go. What are the other opportunities that our young people will have, you know, that are not embedding them in a system that is against them? Mm-hmm. And so that was what's been guiding me since she was in ninth grade. So this work started here. And right when I took the job was actually when the land bank law got passed. Land bank law is a huge deal here in Philadelphia because it will allow the city to take over to lump private property into one parcel, right? So private and public property. Excuse me. So public property and private property has completely, you know, there's two different ways to get access to. If I had my garden, my garden's on four different lots. Those four lots could have four different owners, and those four different owners will have four different processes for me to get ownership of that. And that is like the most confusing thing in the world for people. So most of the gardens in the city are illegal because of this, right? Most of us don't have licenses or leases to be on the land. We don't own the land. We just utilize the land in our space. So, and if we wanted to own the land, it would be really challenging because you have all these different processes. And if you don't know the right people, you wouldn't know how to do the thing. So the land bank was designed to create a process within the city that could lump those things together for a garden, for a developer, for community benefit. And take, if it's a privately owned lot that is tax delinquent, then it can take that into public inventory and group that together and sell that parcel or lease that parcel to a community organization. It's very specific. The language was very specific around development specific to the community, right? Development that would be helpful to the community. So it's not for big developers that are just coming in to put up condos, right? It's very much about low-income housing or mixed-income housing. Not a whole lot for low-income housing, unfortunately. Mixed income housing, you know, community, elderly housing, those type of things, and gardening. And so there was a coalition that formed before I started here called Healthy Foods, Green Spaces, and it was a coalition of urban ag enthusiasts and who came together to help make that to put language, very specific language, into the land bank during the process of them creating and writing out the law. And so it was a really great, it was an awesome effort, mostly institutional. The coalition was mostly institutional. They fought initially, they came together around some zoning laws that they were fighting, and then they stayed coalesced to fight to change and help work with the land bank legislation. And so that had just been passed that December. And it was all these wonderful things, you know, that were supposed to be happening because of the land bank. It was going to make it easier for all of us. And so when I came aboard, one of my jobs was to continue to organize this coalition. But because the land bank had been passed, as the nature of coalitions, you sort of coalesce for a thing, and the thing was over. So most of those institutions didn't come back to the table. And so who was left at the table was like folks who were really invested in working in urban ag and moving forward policy in very specific ways. And so then we talked, Amy Laura and I, about what we really want the coalition to be. And we, you know, said that it should be community informed. It should be community folks at the table. There should be gardeners in this coalition, not just institutions. And then that's what I started to work towards, right? Getting gardeners at the table for the coalition. You know, let's bring some actual people who are on the ground doing the work into this thing. And then while I was doing that work, I realized that actually also I want people to come to the table with their personal politics, not their organizational politics. So that, you know, with coalition, it's challenging because institutions want to be aligned with a coalition, right?
Yeah.
For them, it looks good. But for us as employees, that's really challenging because a lot of times our politics don't align with that organization. So
how do you create a coalition that lets that space grow?
Right. You make it known in the beginning, like you say that, right? You name the thing. And so I was very clear with folks when I invited them out to meetings that, you know, I want you to come with your personal politics. I'm not asking you to be a part of this because you work at food, you know, at Food First. I'm not asking you here because you work at Union. I'm asking you here because you're a grower, right? I'm asking you here because you care about these issues. And so people were down with that. You know, the folks who came were like, oh, yeah, we totally need this. And the folks who came were like, oh, yeah, because we didn't, because it was all white before. There was two people of color in the whole coalition, maybe three people of color in the coalition. And so, you know, now, you know, I was engaging people of color, growers of color around the city, inviting them out to the meetings. They were excited to be connected to other growers of color because a lot of times we feel isolated in the work that we're doing, not knowing that all these other folks are out there doing this work too. And even the folks who were of, there are few folks of, who were of color working in organizations were like, they needed respite as well, right? Away from the organizations that were completely white and not understanding the issues within their communities and still trying to push forward a mission, right? And so this was from what folks tell me, that it was a place of respite where we can come together and like talk about these issues and support each other in different ways, and also break the silos, right? So we were like really keen on the sense that, you know what, we would work better together. You know, even though our organizations have been trying to keep us pitted against each other, this actually works better when we support each other. And that's what we did, and that's what we continue to do. And we changed our name to Soil Generation within a year. Yeah, so that first year of us being sort of coalesced and growing the coalition, we decided that we wanted to be another name. Most of us weren't a part of creating that first name, and we were completely different, right? We looked completely different than that did. So we had this dynamic meeting where we chose our name in like 20 minutes. It was awesome.
It's a great name.
It's a great name, right? And the process was awesome too. When you think of it, we talk about it. All of us are like, yo, it's the best process ever. and it was right. It just felt right when it locked in. It was like, okay, yeah, that's who we are. And so we moved forward as Soil Generation. And then a year later, we decided that we would name the fact that we were Black-led. Because I, you know, being the co-organizer of the thing, we practice shared leadership. And they recognize that because this is voluntarily run, I'm pretty much the only one getting paid to do the thing. So I'm leading and moving the organization in certain ways based on the conversations that we have within the group and that I have with people within the group individually. So that for me is what I consider shared leadership at the time, and also building up folks within the coalition to feel like they can take ownership of the thing, right? So we decided to name it Black-led. It was very important for us to name it Black-led, and a lot of the white folks in the group were very adamant about that as well, because they feel like they understand their liberation is tied up in Black liberation. So when Black people get free, everyone gets free. And that's because we're at the bottom of the, you know, there's a whole theory behind why, right?
Yeah.
Like the whole theory of the press thing. And so the folks who are working within the coalition understand that. So it's multinational, mostly multiracial, purposefully, right? So that we can make sure that all the voices are heard. It's still not as POC as I would like it to be. We need more Latino representation there. We need more, and also recognizing that they also have Latinos in Philadelphia have a large network within themselves, right? In their communities with growing food. So I don't feel a need for them to be there unless it's a need for them. You know what I mean? Like, if you feel like you need to be connected with this larger movement up, then do so. You know, we have Asian folks who are part of the group, which is awesome. And Black folks who are part of the group, and then white folks who have been really growing with us in this process and understanding and releasing their privilege, right, in certain ways, and then using their privilege in certain ways to move things forward. And that brings us up to what I was talking about earlier with changing the dynamics of what the organizations look like, right? So that came up a lot for us in our conversations and our talks and our meetings around, why is my job not hiring people of color? Why is my job not keep hiring people who look like me, it's fresh out of college, who doesn't really have any experience in the, or may not even have any farm experience or growing experience, but because they're, these organizational heads are comfortable, right, with people who look like them, they just continue to hire these people. And people have been fired from raising these concerns at their jobs before. People have been pushed out for raising these concerns at certain urban ag organizations in the city. It was real for a lot of the folks who were at the table. And I was thankful that I was at the table with a bunch of radical people, which was awesome. They were like willing to stand up and take these, And so what we found is that being coalesced as an organization, as a coalition, was actually giving us a little bit more power to push these organizations to do the thing. For me, because I don't work for, because I'm not aligned with one specific organization, and I'm aligned with a law department, when I go talk to a director and I say, why doesn't your staff look like your community? Then I'm heard, right? Yeah. As opposed to just someone off the street or a staff person coming and saying the thing. So the conversations that I was having with EDs when I was meeting with folks was, okay, why does your staff look like that? Why does your board look like that? What are the things that you're doing to change that? How would you like me to help, right? If this is your mission as a food justice organization, then these are the things that you should be thinking about. Economic justice is very much tied to racial justice, and you can't think about one without understanding and acknowledging the other and participating in changing both of those, right? Mm. So people started listening, and I feel like, because there were so many of us, and we were coalesced, that, organization heads were sort of like, okay, I gotta get my shit together. People are looking now, right?
Yeah.
Someone is paying attention to me, right? So then I started getting people started sending me job things when they come in, job announcements, sending me. So now, listen, I'm the gatekeeper of these job announcements, which I hate. But, and on the other hand, I had, this extensive listserv of folks that I've met and, of color throughout the city who may not be connected, who aren't connected in these other ways to these organizations, and I could pass that out to them. So that started a whole another sort of, line of work for us.
Yeah,
to
you became a hub in this network.
So Soil Generation.
A network of empowerment.
Absolutely, right. Yeah. So we were this, and it continues, and we've been really helpful. I mean, we're really blessed to have, gotten lots of people jobs and have had, changed the way people are thinking about their boards. And, so we're pushing the institutions in the city and within urban ag in this really awesome way. Mm-hmm. And also at the same time, we're like, and we still don't like the nonprofit industrial system. So what are we going to do about that? And so we said, let's form a cooperative. Why don't we show them a model of what collectivity looks like, what we could actually do if we were all working together, resourcing together in a way to make sure that the community as a whole in the city is cared for, right?
And that's what Soil Generation has become.
And that's what we have become, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the work with Urban Creators. Is that a part of Soil Generation?
They are an organization.
Within Soil Generation?
Yes, within Soil Generation.
I see.
And I met them through my work here, as going around meeting different orgs and different people growing food in the city. And I immediately got, because they were young people, 26 at the time, 25, 26, and they had taken over this huge piece of land and just were doing amazing things there. And because they had no understanding of the nonprofit system, they had no understanding of, how they should properly, quote unquote, properly do things in a nonprofit way. They were just moving
as a force,
right? Just doing it. And I love that, and I totally support young people doing this thing. That's my thing. I love young people's, you know, especially teens and younger adults and their vision, right? Because their ability to dream, you know, we have that when we're young because we have no fear when we're young, right? We gain that sort of as we get older, right? The more experiences we have, the more fearful we get. And so when folks are young, they just have no fear of, like, you know, repercussion, no fear of, like, messing up, you know, failure. It's really interesting. So they were doing things that other farms weren't doing because they had this, you know, because they were young by themselves and had vision, you know. And so other things that other farms would be like, oh, you know, the large boards that say, that dictate what they can and cannot do, and it's always within the realm of, you know, the possibilities. These guys are just like, we're going to do the impossible all the time. And so they asked me to be on their board, which is the first thing. Before they were part of Soul Generation, they were like, oh, we love you, we want you to be on our board. So that's where I started with Urban Creators. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they came into a coalition. And then as my in my role, understanding that they were having a challenging time keeping a gardener, a farm manager, I said I would do that for them. One, because I love to work in, like, I need to stay on the ground. Like, I can't just do organizing because then I get separated from the community. A lot of times you find, I didn't want to be in meetings all day downtown and not be a part of. So I've always kept a gardening job as well. So when I was volunteering at gardens, when I first started working here, I started also working at the name of that organization? Overbrook Environmental Educational Center.
Mm.
So, and that was because I had met Jerome at that job, and he was the only black man that I knew in the city that had a thing, right? So he was a black man who had an environmental organization. I was like, all right, I'm going to work for you. He literally offered me a job the second week that I worked here. I was like, okay. So I took that job, and it was interesting there, but it was nice knowing that I was working within a black organization and staying on the ground and staying connected to people, but I didn't have a huge community base. And so a lot of times it was just me growing food in a tunnel in a hoop house because he didn't have any actual enough land to grow outside on the dirt. So we were growing inside in this hoop house on top of a garage, very interesting setup. But it's a demonstration garden, so it wasn't really feeding people in a way that, you know, it sort of felt like, okay, this is all for show and not necessarily for actual work. And it was weird for me for a little bit. And so I wanted to be more infused in community, more community-based stuff. So when the issue came there, I was still working at the environmental center, but I said I would finish out their season for them because their farm manager had left early. So I finished out their season. I decided I'm gonna stay here. It's a lot more land. It's on the land. Yeah. I can actually do more growing and we're more community-based. So I left the other job to stay there, to take that one. And so I've been there as a farm manager ever since. But I can't, you know, I'm not working there like most farm managers are there every day and all day long. So luckily I have a farm assistant who's there daily. And I just sort of give direction, put the plants in and that kind of thing. And so we work together. It's a very collectively run organization. So we all sort of help out each other in our roles when it's needed. So, yeah.
This is something that I've been thinking about with the boom that's going on, the building boom in Philadelphia, and this concern about toxics and lead being particularly an issue. And I wonder about the reclaiming land, these lots, these abandoned lots, these vacant lots. What is the process for extracting that to then be able to grow food that's healthy for the community there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so the thing about soil is and plants is that they're amazing, right? and certain plants have the ability to remediate soil, right? And so the studies on soil and contaminants in soil and the uptake of contaminants in soil into food is very varied, actually. And one of the coolest studies I read, we did a whole soil study here through the Food Policy Council in the city, because when the city was like, okay, we're going to give leases out, they're like, what? We need to know what's up with the soil because we don't want to be liable for people getting lead contamination and things. So a lot of times what farms will do, what gardens will do, is they'll build raised beds. Mm. Raised beds bring in soil, compost and soil, and just grow in those to avoid the situation with lead. All farms and gardens are told or advised to get your soil tested when you first start. You know, when you first start wherever, get it tested. It's very inexpensive. You know, it's like $5.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's really cheap. Yeah, you send it in through Penn State Extension or something, and they send it off to a lab, and they send you back your results. There's precautions that you take to make sure that, you know, if you use gloves, you know what I mean, that kind of thing. So, but a lot of our farms are very interested and very kept committed to building soil, right? So a lot of us grow directly in the soil. We're using wood chips. We're using cardboard mulching. We're using different mulching methods that help repair and planting specific plants to help remediate the soil. So we had a young woman came out last year, one of the scientists I know, with a little science soil gun, which is really cool. They have these laser guns now that can just... And it just like gives you soil readings. Whoa. And she said this was like the farm at the Urban Creatives was like Urban Creatives was like some of the best soil she's tested in the city. She's like ever. Like since she's been testing soil in the city, she's never had soil that right that was that clean or whatever. I don't know really what that means because I'm not a scientist.
Yeah.
Like she is, but I was like, okay. Because we actively, you know, we just build wood chips compost, newspaper, cardboard, wood chips compost. And over the years, it's been 7 years now, right? We've built up, and that site was a dump site for years, right? It was an old industrial building years and years ago. It wasn't as bad. It's not, you know, a super fun site where it's not a brownfield, right? Where it was like really everything was destroyed. It was just an industrial site. So, you know, there's a lot of chances that there was all kinds of things in the soil before, right? Including pipes and, you know, all kinds of things under there. And things pop up still, you know, that's how it is with the earth. A lot of farms are actively building soil because we know that we can, right? And that the work that we're doing is helping that in a way that's really, really important for the cities with regards to climate, because it allows us to have, to filter groundwater in a way that is not happening around the city. So, you know, the big thing in the city with global warming is groundwater, right? You know, not having
the increased precipitation.
Yeah, because we have so much concrete. You know, we get charged now a stormwater runoff fee, right? And you get charged a stormwater runoff fee because you live in a city with a lot of concrete, and that concrete is not allowing the rain that comes down to go back into our groundwater system. It washes off, goes into our rivers and our lakes, and it's not getting into our groundwater, which is where we source that drinking water from, right? Mm-hmm. So gardens and not just gardens with not just green space, because green space with grass is a very different experience than when we have plants that have roots, that have deep roots that allow the water to go back into the groundwater source. And so when rain comes down in gardens, it is filtered and goes right back into our groundwater sources, which is very helpful for the cities with regards to flooding, which is why you see now the water department has lots of rain gardens all over the city, mm-hmm. because they are acknowledging that actually plants help the situation with climate change in the city.
That's
in
great.
These ways, as well as like cooling down too, right? So we have, you know, we have more trees and berry bushes and things that are cooling down the systems as we are, you know, heating up in our cities. We have these, you know, when we have these green spaces are allowing us to, you know, cool down. And so there's a lot of different ways that urban agriculture is contributing to the sustainability of our cities, right? Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's always like, why is the city not realizing that and as a whole, right? Because the water department is. But these guys, but they're not, they're like low guys on the totem pole, and when you get to council, it's really funny to watch the whole dynamics. But, you know, but the folks who are in power are still reticent to, like, you know, accept the fact that these are really necessary. They're going to be way more necessary moving forward with climate change the way that it is than they are even now, right? Understanding that these green spaces allow us, afford us a lot of different ways to sustain the systems that we currently have, right? Even though
Great.
We would like those to change,
yeah.
Ones that we have.
This sounds like a good opportunity for us to transition into
That's
our
right.
future visioning
mm-hmm.
part. I'd like to start off by asking kind of some abstract questions, and then we'll just kind of move into visioning piece
okay.
of it. Does that sound good?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything before we move into the future that you want to talk about from the past that we haven't covered?
I don't care. Think of any right now.
Well, the first question I would ask that's sort of the abstract transition is, what are some of the things that you value most, that you love most?
Mm-hmm. People. Land.
Mm-hmm.
Love. That's pretty much it.
Love it. What are some of the things that scare you most, that you fear most?
Injustice and the manifestations of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty much it.
What are some things that you would be willing to fight for?
Things that I do fight for.
Yeah.
Still, right? Or currently. Fight for our right to exist, right? In a way that's meaningful. And so whatever that looks like. But yeah, I'm willing to fight for our right to live meaningful every day. That's mm-hmm. what I'm doing.
What are some of the things that make you most hopeful?
Children. Children make me most hopeful. And seeing their and seeing their response to the natural world around them. It's like, yeah, we'll be okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love it. When you think of the word energy, that's kind of an abstract word itself in some way. What comes to mind when you think of energy?
Right. When I think of energy, I think of everything, actually. So I think of the fact that energy is around us consistently. Everything that we know of is created and you know, by energy. So I think of how large the concept of energy is, and how we sort of narrow it down and think about, like, you know, how do we get our appliances to work, right? Such a small aspect of what energy is to us. So yeah, I think of everything when I think about energy.
Yeah, what isn't energy?
What isn't energy? Right.
Well, let's think a little bit about Philadelphia's energy future. Right now, there's for the future visioning piece, you can go in all these different extremes, business as usual, and sort of a dystopic sort of tale that might happen that way. There's the utopian sort of side that can be all of the dreams, all of our wishes coming true, whatever that might be. And there's maybe a hybrid somewhere in there. So however you want to imagine these futures, these are your futures to dream with. If we're going to launch 50 years into the future, into the year 2067, what does Philly feel like? What does life in Philly feel like? And how is energy a part of life in that 50 years from that future?
All right, so 50 years in the past was...
50 years in the past was 1967.
All
right. Oil was the king energy source. Philadelphia was in the midst of a transition. The nation itself was in a transition, culturally, socially, economically. Issues of gender were just kind of emerging in a lot of contexts as far as power is concerned. The environmental movement was really kind of just sort of moving forward in a different way at that time. And absolutely black identity and black consciousness was continuing to expand at an even broader and bigger rate. So that was 50 years in the past. Mm-hmm. 50 years in the future, in the year 2067.
Right, 50 years in the future.
Talk to me about Philadelphia.
So 50 years in the future for me would probably look like a hybrid situation happening with us trying to get off of fossil fuels, right? I understand, for me, I feel like that's inevitable, right? So inevitably we have to be off of fossil fuels. It's like drugs, right? We can't get off of fossil fuels. And so 50 years in the future, we are transitioning between those two, between letting go of the fossil fuels and accepting more of the renewable energy sources that we know we can achieve, right, that we have access to, that we have ways to create, which for me is understandably, there we have the science of how to harness energy and have had it for over 100 years and how to do so in a way that's free. So the next 50 years we're going to be tricked. It's going to be them trying to figure out how to utilize that, to take that information and put a value to it so that people can't get it for free, right? So that, how do we, you know, sort of like the marijuana thing, right? Like, how do we regulate this in a way that that only certain people have access to the creation of it, and folks who want it have to pay to get it. So it's really the next 50 years trying to create the system of ushering in new renewable energy, right?
That'll be the existing power forces trying to value that, create a valuation on that, to then sell it?
Yes. That's where we would be. So in the middle of that. So it would be pretty chaotic. It's going to be pretty chaotic in 50 years.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What does Philly look like in 50 years? Is it much different from today? Are people moving around in different ways?
Yeah. I think it is much different. It's much wider than it is now. It's a lot more crowded. So in my head, it's more like Hong Kong, right? So... Yeah, there's a lot more people here, a lot more white folks here.
Why more white folks?
Because that's a trend.
For the city?
Yeah, that's the trend. That's what's happening now. Folks are coming back, you know. White folks are reclaiming land that they maybe their parents had years ago and that kind of thing. I mean, the whole gentrification thing is based on, you know, young millennials wanting to come back to the city, but also on our elder folks who are who want to be closer to the resources that they need, right? Who have maybe moved out to rural space, urban or suburban spaces, and where they were driving, and now they don't want to drive so much, and they don't. It's more convenient, right? So the convenience of the city, having things close to you, resources close to you that you need, is appealing to a lot of people right now. So it's gonna, and also that's what the push is, right? So the larger push, you know, internationally, is to get folks into these urban centers, right? We hear all about the super urban centers that are going to happen, and that's based on the fact that all the needs, all the resources are going to be in these cities, right? And in these huge hubs or whatever. So I think it's going to be a lot more crowded and a lot more white folks. That's what it looks like to me. What I think it's going to, competitively, energy is going to be hugely competitive. There'll be a whole lot more players on the scene, right? Because now we have renewable energy folks that are coming into, and folks who were so adamant to stay with fossil fuels are going to be trying to catch up to the folks who already have this. And so that those folks, those companies will be growing, right, and getting more money, and then probably changing, unfortunately, the way that this thing goes, and then probably changing their values based on economic trends, right? And so it may not be so much that they're green, the companies that are right now, like really about this renewable energy, because they think it's the right thing. Once profits start rolling in, it's going to be very much more about money than it is about the green thing, the sustainability. And so they're going to change and be a lot more greedy, right, than they are now, because they're just play fish, small fish now, right? Mm-hmm. When they start getting a taste of what can be, they're going to want more. And so we're going to have a lot more greedy guzzlers trying to get, you know, renewable energy versus sort of like the soda tax thing, where you have these huge soda companies who align themselves with community groups to say, we don't want the sugar tax. It's weird because it serves all purposes. I see that for the energy sources in 50 years. Mm. That's what 50 years
is. In 50 years, what's the food movement that you're building here now? What's it look like in 50 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's a big part of energy, too. Yes. Where are people getting their energy to move? Yes. Right? It's their food.
So I see small groups of, So village style, small groups of land trusts within the city that are caring and stewarding land in a way that is helping to sustain the larger systems, right? As a lot of the time, we hear and we know about these big things, right? Or these big institutions, but the smaller ones are the ones that sort of comprise and make up the what's really happening on the ground, like, which is, and so I think that that's going to continue in the future, and that so we're, you know, we'll have little pockets of land trusts where people are stewarding land in a very thoughtful way and practicing very thoughtful ways of being together on the land in urban spaces.
So more like a neighborhood cooperatives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I say community land trust because this way those folks own and have a stake in the land and where they live. And staying in these cities and helping them to sustain themselves. Because, I mean, for me, I would think that we would all roll out of the city and go live in some rural spaces. But people are really committed to, like, you know, the idea of living, you know, these urban lifestyles. So for those who are committed to living earth style and also committed to the earth, they're going to create their own little small meccas, right? Of earthliness within the city. So there'll be little small groups of banded groups of earth workers.
I love it. Let's move forward and jump to about 123 years. We're looking at the year 2140, so almost 125 years in the future. As a reference point, if we step back in time, 123 years in the past was the year 1894. So this was when Milton Hershey is founding his first chocolate company. Thomas Edison had just built the world's first ever coal-fired electricity plant in New York. And coal had just, in the United States particularly, just overtaken wood as a dominant energy source. This is really before the age of oil as a means of transportation and energy, electricity generation. So that was 123 years in the past. Interested in what 2140 in the future looks like. Long-term, scientists, of course, are anticipating all sorts of climatic effects that could destabilize governments, increase waves of refugees. The precipitation of this area in particular in Philadelphia is expected to rise, as you mentioned, and some of the neighborhoods around our tidal rivers could be inundated and slightly flooded. but there's also potential of a collapse of agriculture as a result of the climatic changes and whether plants can adapt fast enough and whether genetic modifications to those plants could be implemented. So there's a lot of questions about what the year 2140 could be like. It's 125 years from now.
Yeah.
What's your vision for Philadelphia in the year 2140?
Right. Yeah, so 2140 is completely different. So everything's changed. Buildings have changed, right? We don't have the same energy needs as before. Let's say that in 125 years, those folks who have been working under sort of below the radar on different types of energy sourcing have had time to like really put together, you know, the understandings of these, how the workings of energy in our spaces, and how we can harness energy in different ways. And so,
what are some of those ways that you're picturing?
Right. So one of the ways I'm picturing is from life, right? So like I feel like, you know, that we will be able, we're looking towards how we can harness our personal, you know, our bodily energy in order to, you know, so I should be walking down the street and my iPhone is played because it's linked into my system somehow, right, into my body somewhere, and so I am generating the energy that's necessary for my iPod to run, right, as I jog or as I, you know what I mean, or as I'm just walking down the street. So I feel like there'll be a whole lot more ways that people have been able to explore energy sourcing, right? So I don't see big, because it's 125 years later, I definitely see government like almost non-existent, right? Or very chaotic, right?
Mm.
And so not serving the community in a way, them not serving community in a certain way over so much time, people have stopped, you know, sort of buying into government and have created their own little societies, right? And so there's this smaller societies that are ruling, you know, that are creating their own ways of sustaining themselves based on their resources. And so you will have some folks who are really innovative. You have some folks, you know, money folks, who will still be reliant on those large systems to keep them afloat, because that's what they know, right? And those folks who are more innovative will be now, so like the shift, 100, so we were at the 50-year mark, 50 years from then, you know, they were, you know, everything was sort of still as it was, but now 120 years later, you know, folks are separated. There's not so much the thems and the us. There's a whole lot of smaller groups of affinity groups of folks coming together and supporting themselves in specific ways, because they know they have to, because the government isn't serving them. It's been long enough. Folks know this is not the case, and so they've started to create their own systems among themselves. So we have smaller systems that are interplaying with each other, and folks are working together collaboratively to figure out their energy, how to get their energy needs sourced, right? Agriculture and the needs for agriculture, I feel like those folks who were 50 years, who were 70 years before that, who were, you know, in these smaller stewarding land in certain ways, it would be a lot more influential in showing and sharing that knowledge with other people who are understanding a little bit more now. But okay, these guys might have an answer, because where the rest of us are standing in 3 inches of water, these guys over here have this whole water filtration system that is allowing them to exist in a certain way. So how do we do that too? So then you see that the folks who are just stewarding land and living in a certain way start to be the leaders and the thinkers for the how do we break this out. And so those folks now, 120 years later, are so that's sort of the turnaround, right? So now those folks who had to be most resilient, right, because they had the least resources, because they've built up their resilience and built up their understanding and knowledge base due to their having to be resilient, are now the folks who are leading the thing because they know best how to do the thing. And so energy is being sourced in various ways, because we understand that the silos and big things big systems never worked for us. So we are valuing smaller systems, and so there's a lot of small ways that we're sourcing our energy, varied, diverse ways of sourcing energy, not just one big system of coal or one big system of, you know, so yeah, there's a whole lot of...
What do buildings look like? What's it look like to walk, what does it feel like to walk throughout the streets of Philadelphia.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like the streets are spongy. And I feel like the streets are spongy and not really, the cement is cracked up and earth has seeped in. And because the water is so present everywhere and not being able to go back, that it has created, you know, sort of like this marshy, almost slimy, right? You know how you see leftover, like algae sort of like streets. And so, yeah, it's really almost Jurassic, but not, because you still have these large constructions, these large buildings that, you know, that served a purpose at one time, right? So like North Philly now, right? You have this old industrial buildings down there, right? That, and the turn of the century, you know, they were alive and flourishing. Now they're just like broken windows and big giant, you know, those now have, you know, grass and everything. Vines have grown all over everything.
Nature has reclaimed
this. Nature is reclaiming the place to a certain way, most definitely. And then what's happening now is that you don't have these large meccas. We're all the people. And I think that a lot of people are going to be gone. So I think that, you know, that
Philly's population will have shrunk.
Yeah. I think that a lot of populations are shrunk across the world due to climate change.
Yeah,
that a lot of people are going to die, right? Mm. A lot of us aren't going to make it because of this. So the varied, you know, situations that we have with the weather and the land as a response to that, people are going to die. So it'll be a smaller population.
How are those people that are living in Philly? How are they moving around? How are they getting around?
Horseback, just me.
I like that vision.
I know. We all got horses, so maybe some horsebacks. I think that, you know, I think about where the, you know, the future of cars, man. I just have no idea where that's gonna go, right? I just, you know, I think about the Fifth Element often, you know, Bruce Willis and these flying contraptions, and you know, these little tiny parking garages, and I'm like, oh my God, please don't let that be our future. And at the same time, recognizing that it absolutely could be, right? So in my future, we're not so technical. It's not so technical because technology started to, at some point, and we'll go on to that in the 300s. So technology at some point is starting to coexist with the environment, and understanding how they can work together collaboratively in ways that are not so demanding of the earth, right? Because the folks who are doing, the techie folks are understanding that, you know, that they have also a role in trying to save us here, you know, to allow humans to still exist on this planet. Right? Mm-hmm. When I say save us, I mean as humans, because I don't think the Earth is going anywhere. We're not killing the Earth. We're killing our ability to live on the Earth. And so, you know, and so hopefully folks are, you know, being more politicized, right? Through their actions of technology, and now technology is serving the environment in a better way, right? I don't know what cars will look like in that sense. I don't know if we'll be having cars.
Well, let's think even further, because you're mentioning, you're already, I can see you're starting to creep into thinking about what that 300 year mark looks like. So if we launch the year 2312, that's 295 years in the future, as a reference point for us to step back from today, 295 years ago was the year 1722. Mm-hmm. All right, so North America was dominated by Native American cultures across most of the continent. There were some pretty strong white colonization practices happening along the coast, and some battles and a lot of disease being moved because of that. But Philadelphia as a city did exist. It was 40 years old at that point. But the revolution that began in Philadelphia, or was the political hub for it, was another half century into the future. So it's a pretty long time ago. The dominant energy sources by far were wood, along with food and plants. Food and plants that were fed to people or to animals, and then their muscle power is what created most of the energy, along with burning wood and water. So if we're gonna step forward, not 150 years, but twice that, 300 years into the future from today, into the year 2312, What's Philly like?
Yeah, so Philly is, so
this Philly here.
This Philly here.
Yeah.
So I think that we are going to be growing food and growing food indoors, in some ways, sort of like those, not just indoors. So also, right, in order to supply what we need agriculturally, we would have to have created. But much more highly intensely grown food ways, which will require us to do more vertical farm, more vertical growing. Mm. And so you see large paths of, you know, food growing vertically in these really constructive, you know, interesting ways.
So the buildings with that are basically farms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that that used to be buildings, people can't dwell. The dwellings that used to be, but their materials haven't broken down yet, that are still being used, and so they're being used and repurposed in this other way, right? To help to grow food. Technically, we've advanced to the point where we are utilizing our body system. So that's what I was saying before. So we are traveling by our own means. We're able to travel around the city with a thought. In some ways, shielding ourselves or creating or utilizing this body as a machine, right? And in a way that's really moving us around the city. Mm. So like you see those little skateboards, so like a skateboard, but you just want your thing. So we don't really need cars anymore. So cars are a thing of the past because we understand that the shell, this body we have, can be manufactured to create, to travel in these other ways. So we're traveling, you know, with our bodies around to the places that we need to get to and to see the people that we need to see. Our energy sources are still varied, right? We have still a huge amount of different ways that we collect energy to enact the things that we need to do. So we are never again going to be just resourcing one energy. So we have understood that energy, our energy needs have to be met by a diverse system of.
What are some of those different ways you have in mind?
Right. Water, right? So water's going to be hugely present, right? So there'll be, again, you know, we're 300 years in the future, so there's less people because there's less livable land, right? Land that people can actually live on and resource. And so let's hope that Philadelphia is still here. But I feel like the way that Philadelphia is positioned on the oceanic, like in the geographically, that they will, this will still exist, most definitely. Not as large as it is, not as large as a city as it is. We'll lose some, you know, we have lost some feet, you know, maybe a mile in or something like that. But we will still stand, luckily, because we're like not on the ocean's edge, but on the river edge. And also because we're sourced between three rivers, right? So we do have this, you know, this access to fresh water, which is going to bring more people probably down to our area. But on a smaller, but still, because there's less people in the world altogether, mm-hmm. it's not as many as was when it was 50 years later, mm-hmm. right? It's mm-hmm. at the height of, I think, like 50 years from now, it will be like the height of what the population density will be in the city here. Mm-hmm. In 300 years from now, it'll be lessened, of course, but a lot, lessons from a lot, but then also folks from around, right, who are coming into the city to get their resources, certain needs.
So just so I can follow that, the population will peak in 50, from now, mm-hmm. in 50 years, mm-hmm. and then in 120, 125 years, it'll drop, mm-hmm. because they'll be dealing with all these climate effects,
yeah.
But in 300 years, mm-hmm. the population will rise again, but mm-hmm. not quite to that, the crazy levels
but
that
not
it'll
to
be.
The level from, yes.
I love
exactly.
it. Okay. I love this vision.
So right, so we're our energy needs are being met from all different, you know, from all and thoughtfully, right? So but you also have greed. I think that greed is going to always be in the picture.
Less greed.
I said yes, there will be less greed. Greed will always be in the picture, but hopefully less greed.
What do you picture in place? Like, what are the politics and yeah. the way that Philadelphians are interacting with each other?
Right. So hopefully we, I'm hopeful that 300 years from now. I'm not hopeful that the race situation is figured out. I'm hopeful that the poverty situation is figured out, where we have a lot more, a better understanding of what poverty, what was driving poverty, and since that those systems have been, those systems have been destroyed, when the rebuilding of right required those folks who are most oppressed. Are now the knowledge holders, right? And those folks have chosen to exist and to organize in a different way, right? In a way that's not so oppressive of others, right? We're not recreating what was done to us, but allowing something new to unfold. And so, in doing so, there is a lot of opposition. So there's like insurgent groups of like folks who don't want to give up power from the past. who are, like, you know, doing all these really cruel things to, you know, so you have to have some kind of defense. And that defense in 300 years is not going to look like what it looks like now with these really cruel and crude, you know, in ways of destroying people. But these really awesome ways of generating and manifesting energy to protect ourselves and our communities. So you might see large green domes that encapsulates, you know, just the urban spaces where people are dwelling to keep out, you know, negative forces who would come in to destroy us. So we have, you know, understanding energy in a way and being able to harness energy in a certain way to protect ourselves from outside harm. So we would have force fields and things like that that allows us to not, you know, be totally inundated from, you know, other folks who are trying to get to the sources of the things.
Yeah. So one of the things that I heard is the poverty issue will have been solved, or at least moving towards solution in terms of equity. But you said that the race issue would still be present.
Yeah.
Talk to me about why you think that's happened in 300 years.
Yeah. I think that I had a friend years ago, and she said to me, you know, when we look at ourselves as energy beings and understand ourselves to be, you know, to be able to be, create sort of, as creators, we could manifest lots of things if we didn't have fears and different blockages keeping us from doing that, and lots of different things, lots of maybe the ways that we eat food, you know, all these different things that sort of keep us from toning into our real, to the potential of the power that we have within these bodies, right, these shells. And so we were talking about race and how sort of race evolved, right? You know, understanding that as civilization started in what we know now as Africa, right? And so everyone sort of moved from that space around the globe. And so why do we even have these different colors and these different, you know, shades of what we are? It's very much related to our environments and where we ended up being, where our folks laid down roots and contributed to. And then so our conversation was around, like, so but why now, you know, still 2,000 years later, are we still holding these colors, even though our environments and our situations have changed? And she said to me, it was just such a simple response, and it's so weird that I just never thought about that before. She said, because we want to. And so understanding that this is psychological, that racism is not just, you know, was a social construct, but now is being held as a psychological construct. How do we move past that? I think it's going to take a little bit longer. Then, you know, we've been out of slavery, but slavery happened 500 years ago, right? It began around 500 years ago. And what? We are still in the midst of figuring this shit out. So I don't think at all that 300 years from now we'll have that figured out. I don't. I think we'll still be dealing with the race issue. And I mean, 300 years from now, you know, it might be all kinds of different races down here. We could have all kinds of different beings, sentient beings that are, you know, that are living, you know, side by side with us. And we might have energy sources and information that we've never had before based on alien technology and alien influence that we've been pretending that it's not there and allowing that to be a part of our society and acknowledging that, you know, I would imagine that I have no idea what 300 years is going to look like, because I expect to have, and I expect the alien influence to be way more present than and accepted and understood and acknowledged than it is now, right? And that will unlock and open up this opportunity for us to experience and experiment with lots of different ways of being that we haven't in the past, because we've been trying to control the narrative of what is actually out there.
I love it. Is there anything else that you want to share in terms of your vision of Philadelphia and its future, what you hope for, what you're concerned about, what you would love to see happen?
Yeah, I think that I dream about the future and I play in the future in the concept of the realm, you know, sort of future, because I can and because, you know, it's fun. And at the same time, I recognize and acknowledge that I believe that this is design. That there's a perfect design to the way things move within the, you know, and the universe, actually, and that that just our soul, things that are happening here on Earth, and it's a very small part of the changes that we experience here on Earth, that there's this whole universal system that is also contributing to the changes that are happening here. So because we don't acknowledge that, and we don't really have a deep understanding of what is going on universally in our cosmos, we haven't been able to implement that and sort of put that in a place here on our daily lives in order to understand its influence on us in the future, right? So I see the future as whatever it should be, right? When that future comes around, and understanding that this is a perfect design, or just not perfect design, but just a design, right? And that things fall and follow patterns in a way that it was created. Yeah.
I love it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Roger.
Yeah.
This was fun.